Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the final episode of Not About the Weather for the year that has been 2021. A year of great change for us personally and the world. And we would like to congratulate COVID-19 on its season 3 renewal.
Oh, my God.
What, you didn't like that one?
No, I was not expecting that.
We thought we were getting out of the woods, but we're not, are we? We're not out of the woods, and in fact, it might have just gotten a lot worse. But, you know, here we are, end of a second full year in a pandemic-restricted world, and we're gonna spend this episode talking about how 2021 has been for us, our biggest, most impactful hype and our most impactful gripe of 2021. This podcast, if you've never listened to us before, is a general interest pop culture and life podcast hosted by a variety of people who all happen to record together on other podcasts that have more of a focused subject. So a friendly iTunes reviewer called us the greatest podcast about everything and nothing, which is fine and very nice and appropriate. I like to say that we skip the small talk, hence the title, Not About the Weather. But basically, it's all of us who like to hang out on other podcasts that we do together that have an actual point to go off on tangents about the things that we're kind of really hyperfixating on at the moment. So you can find us as a podcast on the website subjectifymedia.com, which is also the home of our other podcasts like Rewatchable and Prophecy Radio and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which is not exactly active, but those are the other podcasts that we host, as well as other things that we have done together over the years. The group of hosts met as journalists on the website Hyperbole, which is now defunct, and once Hyperbole closed its doors earlier this year, some of us got together to make a new hub website for our podcasts and to continue writing articles, and that's subjectifymedia.com. If you want to hear more about that transition from Hyperbole to Subjectify, if you were a Hyperbole reader and you're like, what happened? Episode 37 of this podcast, Not About the Weather, episode 37, is a really in-depth and quite emotional explanation of how we left Hyperbole, or not left Hyperbole, how Hyperbole left us, and how we decided to make this new site, which is really only a couple of months old and really still really in the growth stages of what it's going to be. Most importantly, we wanted to keep our podcasts together in the same platform because we have done, in some variation of them, going into 2022 will be 10 years since Karen and I started podcasting together, for example, we just wanted to make sure that like all of the work that we had done as a passion project still had a hub. So you can follow this podcast specifically on NATW Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, if you like, as well. You can find the show on iTunes or Spotify, Audio Boom, basically anywhere that host podcasts we've kind of distributed to. You can email us as well, natwpodcast@gmail.com. So you can always reach us at any of those places, but we would also really love it if you went to Subjectify Media and you gave them a follow on Twitter as well, at Subjectify Media, again on Twitter and Instagram and everything. The new home of the show and the connection between our four shows that we're doing is pretty crucial as we kind of try and work out how to carry on in this scary new world. So, yeah, I'm Natalie. I'm one of the hosts. I'm joined today by three other people, all of whom I love very much and who I've podcasted and worked with for, again, almost a decade. That's Karen, Brittany, and Ariana. And so, yeah, guys, I mean, I guess that would be a major hype and gripe for 2021, like, I guess, gripe. Hyperbole being pulled out from under us. Hi, we started this new website. So, yeah, Karen, before we get into like our specific pop culture hypes and gripes, how's 2021 been for you?
You know, despite the world being on fire, 2021 has actually been pretty good to me. Hypable closing was not ideal, but I am excited about Subjectify and everything we've done already. And I feel like we're still getting our feet underneath us. And once we get into a real groove, I think that we're pretty much going to be able to do anything, which is always exciting.
Anything.
I think we can do anything.
Okay.
And this was the first full year of me co-writing my books and doing all of that. And that's been insane. But I feel like a year of hard work is finally paying off. And I feel pretty excited for next year.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke to you at the beginning of this year about the Cassie books and, you know, publishing those. And you know, you are turning out the novels pretty fast. Like, some people take a
lot
longer
to write
a novel. You know, they're not long, like, novels compared to some, but is that kind of a necessary evil of Amazon publishing, like, as opposed, like that you have to do, like a high quantity?
Yeah, so it is. If you're self-publishing books, the first three books are really, you need to get those out and under you as soon as possible. And then after that, if you keep putting books out, you know, just being on that roll will help. You can slow down a little bit, but essentially the person that I'm working with, LT Ryan, he's been doing this for a decade. He knows what to do to get a book ranking on Amazon. And he's always said, you know, first three books, put them out 3 months apart. And that is obviously very fast. It's better if you have them stacked up before you do that. I did not. So I have been writing them very quickly and it is stressful, but it really did help keep the ball rolling when, you know, you put a book out, it hits whatever rank it hits. The people who enjoy it go, oh, I really want to read the next one. Oh, I only have to wait 2 months for that. And then they'll go buy the next one. And it kind of keeps that ball rolling. And the more books that you have out that are being successful, that all kind of just stacks on top of each other. So necessary evil, yes. Do I wish that I could take a year to write a book? Also, yes. But it's
I'm
been
glad
okay.
You don't take a year to write them because I read them the day they come out. I am that person. But I will say, I'm Brittany, but I will say I wanted to hype Kindle Unlimited because of this reason exactly. And it's because I get hooked on like a series, like I'll find a series that's like six books long. And then all of a sudden I'll get like so engrossed and then realize like, oh my gosh, like there's a seventh book and then it's like coming out immediately. And then there's two more planned and they're going to be released in like February and March. And I'm like, yes, I don't have to wait that long. So yeah, I personally, as a reader, enjoy this publishing model, but I can imagine as a writer, it's very stressful. However, your books are so good and they're working to my benefit as a reader. So
I'm working on book five right now. It's due in like 2-3 days. So it's
not finished yet. I thought it was already due.
Nope. It's due by Christmas. That was a self-imposed deadline, and let the record show that I am an idiot for saying that, but it's fine. It's going to get done. So soon.
Yay.
Thanks for reading them.
Arianna, how about you with your blossoming television career? How has 2021 been for you in terms of what you've been doing with your life, you know, where you've been living, how you've been working? You know, I know that you traveled down to set a few times. I'm not sure, like, what you can say, but how is your 2021 been?
Oh, it's been fine. I did want to say, like, Karen, I'm so, so impressed with you. Writing a book is harder than I think anything in the entire world. And I just think you're amazing. And I can't believe you write so many books in a year.
It's really a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, like Karen said, personally, I mean, things are fine. I'm quarantining from COVID exposure, like apparently everyone else on the planet is right now.
Yeah, it's gotten worse again.
But aside from, you know, the pandemic and the world crumbling around us, like professionally, this is like the best year I've ever had. So that's cool. I feel like I've grown a lot as a writer and in some ways as a human. So that's nice. I've gotten some really incredible opportunities, but I also feel like the things that happened this year, I got to earn in a really nice way. Like it's years of work coming to fruition. So that's,
yep.
That feels nice.
Yeah. I mean, there's a slow grind with a lot of this creative work that I'm just so not cut out for. Like you have to really want it to like grind that hard and put up with all the things you put up with, or, you know, do so, you know, so many different, you know, trial and error things, jobs, you know, just all that kind of stuff to be able to get to really start being able to like, yeah, like express yourself or get those opportunities. Is there anything specific, Ariana, that you can talk about that you liked, whether it was something to do with Roswell, just, you know, in the past that's already happened, or anything that you were, you know, really excited to do?
I feel like the most exciting things, I mean, are coming, I can't talk about yet, but I can in 2 weeks, if you can just hold out 2 weeks.
God. Okay, well, first episode of Not About the Weather 2022, we'll talk about it.
But yeah, I just keep thinking back to the like this time last year, like literally 1 year ago where I was at, which I was already like getting some opportunities, but like I was a PA a year ago, and the only thing I wanted more than anything was like getting representation, and now I have that, and now I have a lot more than that. And I'm just so grateful how, I don't want to say like how quickly things can change, because I definitely have been working a long time, but it felt slow for so long.
And when did you get an agent?
I got a manager in the spring. This is boring stuff. We don't have to talk about this.
It's not boring. It's definitely not boring. And you're the one that is always like, we need to get people on the podcast to talk about this kind of stuff, like writers and like various stuff. So no, don't be a hypocrite.
I got a manager in around April of last mm-hmm. year. But, you know, I graduated from school when 2012, so like almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've been writing my whole life. So you know, I remember back when I like, even before, like when I first graduated from school and I was, you know, working my 9-to-5 at an oil company where everyone was so nice, and I'm very grateful, but I was working like at an oil company, filing mail and like inputting in data. And all I did all day was like, listen to Hypable podcasts and like listening to, this was even like before you guys were my friends, but like listening to you guys talk about, media, and like, that was my escape. 'Cause it felt like, I don't know, it was the stuff I love to think about and talk and dissect this stuff. 'Cause that's how we think of, I don't know if everybody thinks of of stories that way, but that's how we think of stories. We dissect it like it's an English lit assignment. So
engaging on that level. Yeah.
So like that was my escape. And now to think that like I'm getting to help make some of that stuff is really cool.
You know, one of my favorite things about TV writers, about all of the TV writers that I'm friends with, is like how, and this is why I think, you know, they are great podcast guests and we want to get like more people who write for shows and stuff on just to interview, because one of the things that I've really discovered is like all of that kind of analyzing, that meta, that kind of, you know, how, you know, people say fans are like crazy for like how much time, you know, really fanish fans for how much time they think, you know, spend thinking about you know, the inner motive of the characters or stuff that, you know, how they interpret things on screen. And from my experience with TV writers, no one thinks about that more than the writers. Like they think about it so much more than what gets to be actually shown in the few words and scenes on screen. Like they have, you know, I think a good TV writer has so much obsession with the inner life and the implications of what they're getting the characters to do. And I think it's really cool. There are like so many TV writers coming up of our age and our generation and our level of engagement with fandom and, you know, stuff like that, that, you know, kind of using that brain to actually make like better and deeper TV. So I'm really excited. Like I really loved, you know, I won't, you know, I can cut this out if you want, Ariana, I won't give any details, but like Ariana pitched to us earlier in the year about a potential project that, you know, I won't say any more than that or, you know, what happened, but just hearing her pitch and hearing like her idea for the story that she was pitching, that was one of my favorite things that I saw this year. You know, like it was so cool to to see you lay out your storytelling like that. So I'm excited for you too.
Thank you. That's really sweet.
Brittany, how has your 2021 been? Obviously you usually go all over the place and go to conferences and, you know, deal with all of these important medical people and travel to interview doctors and stuff. And this year you've stayed in your apartment. So do you miss that element of your job?
I do, actually. I had a pretty crappy 2021. I'm not going to lie. It was bad.
Yeah. We talked about it last month. Brittany had a real, real bad time.
Yeah, 2021 was not great. Professionally, it was good in terms of like career advancement and taking on more responsibilities and really kind of solidifying that I do love what I've ended up doing. Somehow stepped into this job, but I absolutely love it. But there were some changes and things. There was not a lot of support at work. And so I am coming down from that and I'll have 10 full days off starting in about 24 hours. So my brain is already starting to turn off. So this could be a real fun podcast. It started shutting down today at around 5:30 PM, but yeah, not a great year overall. I will say not a great year, but, I think I'm looking forward to next year. I'm looking forward to resetting during the next like 10 days and coming back and having a better grasp on what to expect instead of just trying to play catch up in what I've been doing. So, yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. So, Brittany, that's okay. You didn't have a great year. I had a completely static year, like absolutely, you know, we had a second lockdown in the middle of the year. I'm still stuck in my house that's not completely finished renovating because the builders can't come back because of the various COVID things. I mean, our numbers are nothing compared to the USA, but they are going back up again as of the last few days with our new, you know, version O. Yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed building Subjectify, like the technical side. That was a really interesting thing for me this year to like basically be faced with this project that I literally did not know how to do. Like when I started it, I was just like, what do we need? And how do I work out how to do it? And I think that I did it. I mean, jury's still out.
You definitely did it.
It's not perfect, but I don't know. It was it's given me a bit of perspective on, I guess, like my driving forces and my motivations. You know, getting back into writing even casually has been tough because I have been stuck on it for a few years. Like I'm definitely not like Ariana and Karen in that, like, I've never had a true drive to be a, you know, creative writer for a job, like to that hustle. Like I've never, that's not really in me. And I think that it would burn me out to try. And so I have like a huge amount of respect for people who like do it because they cannot imagine being fulfilled by anything else. Whereas nothing fulfills me. I'm an empty shell. So that's fine. But it has been really interesting, like just skills wise, and just kind of thinking about like what those skills could do in the future. But I've also really appreciated working closely with Karen again after a couple of years of her not really being too involved with Hyperball, like in the creative sense, due to various things that she's had going on. Because yeah, I think Karen and I have a very strong working relationship, more so than pretty much anyone. No offense, Brittany, even though we've written together so much, in terms of actually like creating and running projects, Karen and I have a very long history and a lot of experience. And you know, we used to say on the Teen Wolf podcast that like we could read each other's silences, like that we could tell, like just from like a silent beat, like what the thought was. And reinvigorating that partnership this year has been pretty good, don't you think, Karen?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Because I mean, I was a little nervous. Like we had kind of both been working at Hypable, but in our own little spheres, and we hadn't really collaborated pretty much since Teen Wolf had stopped. And it was like, we should definitely do this again, because we already knew that we could work very closely together. But this was like a whole different beast from just doing a podcast. This is like that times 100. And it was surprisingly seamless.
Yeah. I love writing with Brittany, in terms of we're going to have to pull together some projects to do that in 2022. Like I, you know, on Hypable over the last few years, Brittany and I shared coverage by actually like doing basically like written podcasts, like conversation reviews. And that's a really great format that I really want to bring on to Subjectify as well. But yeah, on the kind of production level, Karen is a great partner, and I've been really happy to, to do that with her and kind of, you know, be able to send her random, sometimes very curt, like lists of thoughts and stuff, and just like basically, you know, I think we're so close as production partners that like it was just very easy to understand each other, whether it was in a hurry or like, you know, we don't really argue. And it's been a highlight for me.
You both, I just wanted to say, sorry again, yeah, to compliment you guys, but what you've created is so impressive. I like, it's beautiful and it's wonderful. And I'm very impressed that you guys like took this lemon and made the best tasting lemonade.
Thank you.
Just, I did not know that this podcast was going to be full of compliments. Otherwise I wouldn't have shown up. I'm very stressed out right now, but thank you.
Yeah. And I'm glad to get everyone re-engaging again. Like, you know, Ariana's obviously very busy, but she's got such a great mind and she's got such a great perspective on the things that she loves as a fan that I, you know, really am glad to keep her on our podcasts, and maybe she'll be able to write articles again in the future. But we're going to, you know, be doing more rewatchable with Ariana, and we're going to be, you know, doing all sorts of things. You know, I've got this new column on Subjectify, which is like throwback reviews, like third Thursdays of the month is going to be a throwback to review something that's old, that's not like current, either something that you've just discovered that's old or an old favorite of yours that you want to write a current present day state of mind review about. And we did two of those for December, and one of them was very, very well publicized. And I think that that was a really good way to engage like you know, creators of stuff that like still like people talking about their work. And I'm really curious for everyone currently here, Ariana, Karen, and Brittany, like to see what ideas they might have for a throwback review, for example, because that's kind of linked to rewatchable in a way. Like it's in the vein of either a newbie or a super fan of an old thing writing a present day assessment of it. So that's something I'm really excited about for 2022. And yeah, we'll see how it goes. Anyway, the main body of this episode is going to be us talking about our big, you know, general pop culture slash, you know, media engagement hypes and gripes of 2021, the biggest overarching thing that has been in your mind and in present in your life for 2021, an obsession to share and a grievance to air 2021 edition. And, you know, maybe we'll go away from this podcast and be like, oh, I should have said that. But I do feel strongly about my choices, and I think everyone feels strongly about their choices. So this is, you know, a bit of a snapshot of the predominant things that has been on our mind for 2021. Do you guys think we should do hypes first or gripes first?
Let's gripe first.
Yeah, let's gripe. I like to leave out on a high note.
Okay, cool. Brittany, given that you said that so dramatically right off the back, I want you to start with your overarching 2021 gripe, because it's very interesting.
This came to me in like such a random like burst of thought like an hour ago, and I don't know why, because I have not like seen anything remotely related to this man in months, yet whenever I think about this, it drives me crazy. So when thinking back on like 2021 and like pop culture and media stuff, I really only sought out things that I knew would make me happy. And so I don't have like a ton of things to really complain about, I guess, mm-hmm. which is good. But there is one thing. And on the heels of like the most stressful election season, everyone sort of like dug in and became fans of Steve Kornacki. So 2021, executives just tried to keep making him relevant when it wasn't his job. Like he had no reason to be on Sunday Night Football. He had no reason to be used in like this hot, there was this horrible, horrible Halloween thing that they did on NBC this year. And it's just, I felt like he was being used and he had to talk about things that he probably didn't care about, but because they just wanted him to use the big screen and circle some stuff. And I felt really bad for him and his khaki pants. And he probably just wants to like go home and study the counties in Georgia and live his life. And I just hope they leave Steve alone.
So is this man actually a political analyst, or is he just a man with a board? Like why was he on football?
So he's like a statistician. And so he like works with numbers and projections, but he mainly works in politics and sports he could work with, but the numbers that they were giving him to break down, like he was, so for football, for example, they brought him on to do like this playoff projection, and there's nothing there for him to do. It was like, if this team wins, they have like a 63% chance of beating this other team. And it was boring, and they just wanted to have Steve Kornacki. It was like the same thing as like when they bring on the Muppets and they're just like, Kermit's and Miss Piggy are going to make a special appearance, and they're just like sitting behind a desk being like,
you think, so you think they were like tokenizing him? Yes, or like they making him into like a trivial, like how would you say it, like a trivial like a gimmick?
Yes. And like the Patriots were really bad last year, and one thing that I really appreciate about Steve Kornacki is that he is a Patriots fan. And so like, he couldn't even like talk about the team that he likes because they weren't in the playoffs. And so, you know, it bothered me. I really like him. I liked him several elections ago before they started doing all of this stuff, but they keep bringing him in for you know, playoff stuff. And they just did it again a few days ago. And, you know, it's just poor Steve. I don't want him to be roped into all of this stuff. He was, oh, now I looked it up just to see what else they've been like roping him into. And this is a headline. Christmas by the numbers. Steve Kornacki reveals America's holiday favorites. Does he want to be doing this? Like,
I mean, he's accepting the jobs. Do you think they're paying him a lot?
Probably not. But I mean, I love him. I think he's great. I'm looking forward to a couple of elections just where I can like see him share his knowledge. He's like very good at memorizing things. And he loves index cards and doing math. I love Kornacki Cam, like when there's an election and they like go to commercial, but they stay on Steve. So I just didn't like seeing him used like that. And he, you know, it's not his thing.
I'm obsessed with you. I am.
Let Steve be Steve.
It's so.
Such an inconsequential hype. Like, I'm sure he's fine, but I'm very concerned about him.
It's so perfect. Yeah, that's why we love to talk about things on this show, because something like this can become like the biggest problem in your life. And it's real. Like, it's really taking up that much brain space for you. So I appreciate,
like, seeing him
you.
Used to bring me joy. And the first time they brought him on like Sunday Night Football, I was like, yes, great, this is fantastic. And then I watched it and I was like, oh, no, we're not going to be doing this. We should not be doing this. And yet here we are, December 2021, and we're still doing it.
I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts on him. I only know about him through Britney / I guess the internet at an election, that he is a thing that people like. But yeah, I know that this has been a really passionate thing for you.
I appreciate this. I feel Steve Kornacki has strong Britney energy. I don't know how to quite explain that.
Well, he has Green Brothers energy. And that to me is Britney energy in a way.
I'll take that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I hope that they, you know, treat him better for you next year. Maybe you should, like, write him a letter and be like, I hope that you're okay. Okay. Karen, do you want to go next with your 2021 gripe?
Sure. I feel like this is a good segue because it's kind of Britney related, in that I associate Melissa McCarthy with Britney. So did you see Thunder Force, Brittany?
Yes, of course I did.
Did you like it?
No, of course
I did. Okay, good. I was going to be real scared if you said that you liked it. So for anybody who doesn't know, Thunder Force is a superhero movie that starred Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer and Jason Bateman. Who was surprisingly my favorite part of the movie, actually. I was not expecting that, but it's basically was kind of pitched as like, oh, plus size superheroes. You know, it was meant to be like an action comedy kind of movie, which is my jam. I love action movies and don't mind action comedy stuff. And I was really looking forward to this because I like both of them and I was ready for it. And it turned out to be so dumb. Like, I expected it to be a funny movie, maybe a little ridiculous, but I don't think the trailers really gave away the true tone of the movie. And Melissa McCarthy's movies for me generally land, not like every time, but I usually like her stuff. And I was just really disappointed in this one. I feel like they could have done so much with this, given that superheroes are huge right now and that there's not a lot of representation for like plus size superheroes and people on screen. And these two are just like legends. And it felt completely flat and to the point where I was going to review this movie and decided that I couldn't find a single thing that I actually liked about it. So that was real unfortunate.
Oh, that's, yeah. And it did all of this without particularly punching down to the fat. That's the, like you're saying, like, despite the fact that it didn't punch down about fat women, it still wasn't good.
Yeah. And that, I think, you know,
that's the killer.
It is, because they knew what they were doing. They made this movie because it wasn't meant to be a joke. It was meant to be them as superheroes. And the story was just so bad. I feel like if they had even tried to change the script to something else, it would have been an improvement. And I just feel like, you know how when they did Ghostbusters, the all-female Ghostbusters, and like it crashed and burned in theaters, and they were like, oh, this is why, you know, we can't let women lead movies and stuff like that. Like, they never should have done this. And we're never going to get a sequel to that movie, despite the fact that I loved it. And I feel like it's kind of the same thing here. Like, nobody's going to try to do this again for a long time. Whereas like right now might be the perfect market for it. So it's just very frustrating.
Karen, this has 21% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's low. That's
and really I like low. Terrible movies. That's like half my personality.
I
so this
her.
Cast is amazing. Like, this is shocking.
Bobby Cannavale. Like, how is this movie bad? Like, I don't know.
And Ben Melissa Ponzio is in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She was cute. I liked her part.
I think she needs to get away from her husband. I love them together, but she can't be in his movies for a while. I think it's, I think he needs to take a break from making movies and like really assess his own writing, because it's not great. But they're like, they are so great together and have such a good like working partnership. But this movie was just so unbelievably bad that I actually like had to check afterwards, like when the credits rolled, I was like, wait, there's no way like he wrote this. Maybe they just like did it as a favor to someone or something, but no, he wrote it. He directed it. It's just, it is not good. It is not good.
That sucks.
Has anybody seen Tammy?
That's my all-time favorite movie.
She loves Tammy.
I love Tammy.
Well, he wrote that one. I haven't seen it, but I wanted to.
Yeah, but it's also like 7 years ago or something. I feel like we need to. I want her to do something like, I don't know. I don't know what I want her to do. I want her to do something so drastic that it's not this cookie cutter type of thing. I think they got this made because on a surface level, it fits what they were like, okay, we have check all of these boxes, it'll be a good movie, instead of like actually.
I mean, I think it goes to show it. That like your story has to matter, like even exactly. If you're doing the right things in terms of like representation.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, because that element that it's like, you know, obviously in a gross other time, like, yeah, like fat female superhero could be like a farcical, disgusting joke, but the fact that that isn't this, but it's just like not a good story, sucks, because like, you know, and like, yeah, I just feel like when you write a story, you have to really put the story first. Like, you really, like, you know, it's not rocket science, but like you really do. I, you know, I don't like to see people, I guess, like, yeah, backpedaling their story. You know, it should always come first, and then, you know, what you consciously add into it, you know, should be part and parcel of it, I guess. Like, you know, the premise, you know, your premise is this is your, these are your superheroes, and this is what we want to say about them. But I don't know, was it just like a collection of set pieces that didn't like have any cohesion? Like, was it like kind of a bunch of gags, or was it like just literally a bad story? Was it boring? Like,
I think I think the first half was like decent, and it was setting up the story and getting you to the point of them like becoming superheroes. And it kind of hit a lot of the main beats of these sort of stories where you have the setup and everything, and you had like their two friends who weren't really talking anymore, and you kind of have their relationship issues. And then you have the superhero montage in the begin or in the middle. And I think up until that point, I was like, you know, this movie's okay. Like, we're going to see how it is in the second half and see what happens. And then from then on, yeah, it just all felt like gags, like stupid jokes that I didn't find funny at all. And it just felt very tired to me. There was nothing new or fresh or funny about it.
I don't know. The only thing I can remember seeing, like really loving Melissa McCarthy in, I haven't like seen that much of her stuff, is like St. Vincent, which is like a drama. Like, it's completely not, it's not like in any way a comedy. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like a slapsticky comedy. Like, it's a comedy drama. Bill Murray's in it. And it's basically about this guy, you know, this kind of like down and out guy who ends up like babysitting his neighbor's child. In Sheepshead Bay, like it's all in, set in Brooklyn in New York, and it's kind of a more serious dramedy, and it's not like a kind of goofy movie in any way. And I don't know, what's is Tammy your favorite of her films, Brittany, or do you, is there another one that you like best?
Well, I don't know. Well, Tammy is probably my favorite, but I don't, and I don't know really why, because it's arguably not a great movie, but I absolutely loved it from the moment I saw it. I saw it in theaters, and I think I saw it twice in theaters, actually. And I just loved the, like, the journey of Tammy. And so, but she's like a ridiculous character. I think my favorite Melissa McCarthy role is her in Gilmore Girls, but in terms of movies, I think Tammy's probably up there as my favorite. Also, you know, I personally relate the most to Megan in Bridesmaids, but that's just, you know, me.
Well, she's definitely also had the, you know, like, I don't know, did you see that, like, the biopic you did? She did have, like, Lee Israel, like, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Like, a full drama? Like, how is she?
Yeah.
Great I drama.
I thought Can You Ever Forgive Me was very good. Yeah, she's such an like adaptable actress, but she doesn't, I don't think she does enough with it.
Maybe she doesn't enjoy like drama. I don't know.
Yeah, she's in a new drama actually that I keep seeing like on, she was posting about it for a while on her Instagram, and I keep forgetting to like seek it out, but yeah, I don't know. Like, she's great in The Heat, Identity Thief. Like, I
love The Heat.
Yeah, The Heat is so good. We talked about it a little bit on Rewatchable, actually, when we were talking about Sandra Bullock. But yeah, I don't know. I love her comedic roles, but this was just not one. Like, you kind of know what you're gonna get when you see Melissa McCarthy's cast in a comedy, but this was not what I wanted.
I'm sorry. Maybe next year.
Maybe next year.
I'm going to go next with mine, my gripe, which was a big disappointment in the ending of one of my favorite shows. So Brooklyn Nine-Nine ended this year in 2021, and I think that was good. Like, I think there was a lot about it that I liked, and I kind of liked the decision that they did to end the show. It seemed to me to be very clear that, especially after the events of 2020, in terms of the George Floyd murder and in terms of just the amount of exposure, you know, police brutality was getting. I don't know this for a fact. I did try and look up some stuff about it, but it feels like that the show, like the showrunners, kind of finally were like, we are making propaganda in this show and we don't want to do it anymore. Like, we don't think it's right to to perpetuate this, and like our characters are like a delusional idea of cops. Like it's not right to keep making the show. And either way, they announced, like, not a cancellation, they announced that season 8 of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which was the final season, was going to air in 2021. And I had a pretty strong feeling that the season would deal with this, like, head on, like, would deal with the issues of the real world, you know, in at least a way that, you know, was in somewhat in line with their level of comedy. And that was true. That did happen. And it actually happened more strongly during the season than I expected it to. So, you know, I am going to spoil the events of season 8 of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So if anyone's listening who doesn't want to be spoiled for that, just skip this bit. It does start with, you know, the immediate announcement, you know, that it's kind of set, you know, however long on from season 7, after Jake and Amy had their baby, Rosa has quit the police force entirely because she can't stand for basically what the police force has become, or like what policing stands for is something she no longer stands for. Like she can not ignore the cultural rot within policing in America anymore. So they do tackle that head on, and she never comes back to being a cop. She works as a private detective during the season who does try and help, you know, civilians solve problems, but outside of the structure and the systematic levels of policing. And all through the season, you know, you do have quite a few important episodes that deal with that head on, you know, especially with Holt, you know, kind of there's a really, really, Andre Brower has a really amazing moment that is talking about how tough it's been in the last year or decade, you know, to be a Black man in America and to be police in America and all of that. And the season makes a really good effort to basically focus a bunch of episodes on the characters that's like completely outside of policing. Like the episodes are either generally about a problem with policing or an episode that deals with the characters in a humorous way that has absolutely nothing to do with them being cops, like going out and to stay in the woods, a cabin in the woods, and help Holt and Kevin get back together, for example. Like, so all through the season, they are building this, especially for Jake. Jake, you know, we see Terry and Amy trying to, you know, do good. Holt and Amy put together a proposal for training on police reform for the NYPD that they're trying to push through. One of the biggest enemy of the season is John C. McGinley. He's like a police bureaucrat who basically is shown to be like getting off a lot of cops from accusations of whatever they're doing, like discrimination or profiling, or, you know, he's someone who helps cops get away with doing bad things as cops. And early on, Jake does something that he realizes is bad. Like Jake profiles someone and he basically is like, oh my God, I've done this. This guy, John C. McGinley, tries to help him get off from it, and Jake basically is like, fuck you, no. Like, and like purposely incriminates himself, even though the guy is saying, like, don't say that, don't admit you made a mistake, don't admit that you did something wrong. Jake goes on suspension for 5 months. All of this, all season, I'm like, they are really going there with it. Like, I really, like, it was a lot more conscious than it was as conscious as I had hoped them to be, I guess, is a way of putting it. And all this, there's even an episode where Jake helped Doug Judy escape from police custody and leave the country because they got his crimes acquitted in New York due to his cooperation, but he had a warrant in Jersey and basically got pulled up and was going to go back into prison for something like very minor. And there's a whole episode about Jake breaking him out of the country, basically, because he found the fact that, you know, and lots of speeches about like, wow, this system is fucked, and, you know, how, you know, the people who like actually haven't done anything wrong or have, you know, improved in certain ways, like, you know, they can have their whole life derailed by like something like this, kind of like, you know, not having the, you know, a warrant for their arrest because they can't afford to get like their car thing renewed or like something. This is all to say that like all season I was really hyped up at the amount that they were actually looking at it head on, especially for Jake. and his change. And all season I was like, I know that Jake's going to quit. Like, it starts with Rosa and Jake are big mirrors in the show, and it starts with Rosa quitting. And all the season long, you're like, Jake's going to leave. Like, you know, he gets suspended for 5 months. He's constantly learning, basically. You know, we're kind of taking the rose-colored glasses of the Brooklyn Nine-Nine squad off and looking at the reality of policing in New York. And then in the finale, like, he does quit, but they completely don't say a single word about it having been related to policing. He quits. He ends up quitting because he becomes a stay-at-home dad for his son. Amy and Holt get promoted. Like, Terry, you know, we see, like, Terry stays at the force and becomes the captain. Amy and Holt are promoted to the head office to run a reform program. So they're doing good, like, they're trying to do good from within the system. But it was all leading for me to Jake being like, I am not the right man for this job. Like, I am disillusioned. My idea of, like, what's my idea of me being a hero has been, like, so firmly disillusioned, like, for the better, like, in terms of recognizing his biases and his privileges. It all felt like it was leading to Jake quitting because he thought it was wrong for him to be a cop. And he does quit, but it is only tied to him being a stay-at-home dad. Like, the Amy's work, the whole season also has, like, you know, oh, we're trying to juggle this, you know, two working cop parents and this baby. Amy gets this amazing opportunity, you know, to do good, and Jake quits to be a stay-at-home dad. And never in the conversation about him leaving the force, like, once that's decided, it's never, ever, 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 ever even said in a single line that that decision is in any way influenced by all of the stuff that he's happened to him all season about his reassessment of policing. It's kind of like they leave the idea on the ground because the season has shown you that, but they don't have him say, I'm quitting because I'm the wrong man for this job. I'm quitting because I'm, you know, this is not actually the good that I can do in the world. And I felt so let down by this for some reason. I don't know, like, why they didn't say it, if that was, like, a step too far, if they weren't allowed to say that, like, if they weren't allowed to actually say that out loud by, I don't know, network or studio or whatever, because it's pretty obvious. They spend the whole season saying it, but then they don't say it. And they kind of bury his quitting in it just being about being a stay-at-home dad and wanting to be, like, good for his son, which is totally valid, but I felt really let down by not actually giving him that moral thrust in his decision to leave policing. And I love this character so much that it really bothered me. And I still like the finale. I love, like, the ending. There's an ending shot where they're all leaving the building for the last time. They're all going in the elevator, and there's, you know, there's a janitor, Dan, has been hovering around the episode, like Dan Gore, the showrunner, and he kind of has a little cameo pushing them off. And there's this amazing, like, shot. The last shot is, like, him, the squad in the elevator, the doors closing, and Andy has this, like, knowing smile back to Dan in the building, who's mopping the floor, like, this connection between them as the producers. And, you know, I still cried in the finale, but this dropping of this issue, which was clearly an issue that they were trying to tackle head on, really stuck with me. It really bothered me. And I really love this show. I really love the way that they've transformed from being, like, kind of a cheap laughs show in season one through to the things that they've ended up tackling, the way that they've portrayed what policing potentially should be, what, you know, how masculine relationships, you know, women in police, you know, just in general, like, a lot of interesting friendships and relationships in the show, you know, different people of color in different, from different backgrounds, sexualities. Like, I love this show, and I just felt really bothered by that dropped ball. And I just kind of want to know why. Like, I want to know why they didn't actually, like, make that clear. I don't know. I know some of you guys have watched Brooklyn and some haven't, but, yeah, did anyone else actually keep up to date with the finale?
I didn't.
I didn't either. I didn't watch the final season.
Mm-hmm.
But I love this recap you gave of it, Natalie.
Sorry, I just got, like, really went. I've talked about it a bit in some group chats, but I haven't really talked about it, and it's really Like, I feel quite let down, and I kind of, but I almost don't feel like it was, I feel like something was going on. I don't know. Maybe I might be wrong, but I feel like something was going on.
I did keep up with recaps of it while it was airing. I feel like you have a more nuanced take than the recaps I read.
Oh, what did I didn't read any recaps. What did they have to say?
No, I just feel like they weren't, and I tend to believe you more because you do dig a little bit deeper. But I feel like they didn't have as much of a, in terms of Jake's journey, I feel like they didn't, because it wasn't spelled out. I feel like the recaps I read didn't feel like he was leaning towards leaving. Or at least
I felt it from the first episode of the season. I was like, he's gonna leave, because the first episode of the season is called The Good Ones, right? And it's like, I'm one of the good ones. I'm Rosa quits and Jake keeps attempting to like prove to her that no, she's, you know, I'm a good cop really. And he basically finds out some really disillusioning things about like the truth of like how most cops operate, like, because it kind of, you know, strips the lens away that, you know, because our squad at the 99 is like ridiculously amazing people, and you kind of see him get disillusioned with people that he thought were good. Yeah, I thought from the very first episode of season one that he was going to quit, and then once he got suspended, he took the suspension, like he forced disciplinary action on himself when the guy, John C. McGinley, was like, no, don't say that. Don't, you know, like, oh, now you've said the thing that means like legally on paper, we have to do something, like, you know, trying to basically get him out of it. And he forced the suspension on himself. Jake did. And then with Doug Judy, you know, he committed a felony. So I felt it was very clear that he was going to quit, and it felt like it was for moral reasons. And while him being a stay-at-home dad is super important with his arc as a, you know, his arc with his own father, I felt like they let him down, like, as a character in a big way, and it really bothered me.
I think something else, like, Natalie, because you keep saying like you feel like something went on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Something else that's important to remember, as I tread carefully, is that most people in power, be that, you know, upper level writers who have spent decades working, or executives who have spent decades working, most of these people are not as, they're not in touch with what's going on socially in the same way that you and I are, or people who are like engaged with social media or engaged with the news in a way that's much more relevant. I don't know. Like, that's much more like what's happening now. Engaging with people in a much more live way. Most people are not in power, are not like that. So something that I thought was really interesting, not interesting, but I'm saying interesting, is like in the reaction of all of this, like the response to copaganda, I feel like was almost to create more copaganda. Like, it's interesting to see new shows pop up that the lead is a cop.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Or, you know what I mean? Like, the lead is the cop. But
the different,
it takes to pains for them to say like, oh, but he's one of the good cops. Let me show you how good of a cop he is. And he's such a good cop that it pains him. Like, he just wishes people understood that he's trying to do the right thing. Yeah. And like, and really you're the bad one for not understanding that he's trying to do the good right thing. And like, it's interesting that that was the response for so many.
It seemed like, you know, jokes. People were really trying to double down on.
To be like, no, but our like, cop is no. good.
You know, like, you know, that they don't want to confront the reality of it.
Yes. Like, our cop is good, even if he's done bad things that, you know, are illegal. Like, our cop is good.
That's why I found it so interesting that Brooklyn chose to end. And while I definitely do wonder what was going on behind the scenes, like, if you watch, like, season 8, the episodes, like I said, like, it's interspersed with episodes 100% don't deal with policing at all. They're like, we are, here's our gang of characters that we know and love, and we're going to Charles's family's uncle's funeral, and we're going to the woods to get Holt and Kevin back together. Not like a cop show, just a show about people that we know. And the episodes that do deal with cop stuff, they're all very critical, like very, very, very critical. Like, it really goes up against the bad things about policing, and it really goes up against, you know, really, you know, it starts talking about, like, reform, you know, like, the, you know, the way that they can, there's one episode where there's, like, a strike of uniformed officers because of an anti-cop, like, they deal with the public being really anti-cop, and they kind of take the side of the public being really anti-cop, and there's a strike of, like, douchebag uniformed officers who are, like, opposing anti-cop behavior, and Amy manages to, like, redistribute people to prove that we need less cops, and like that they can be deployed, like basically distributed the right, you know, distributed resources to show that you can like have the same level of crime or incidents with less bad cop incidences with way fewer cops, you know, deployed smartly. And then she goes to write this whole like reform proposal, like, you know, you can imagine like Amy Santiago's attitude towards policing. But the show went pretty hard at saying the system is very bad. They said it through Jake as the white male hero. And then at the close, I was expecting him to quit very much, but they don't draw a line between him quitting and the events of the season, aside from his son. Like they just, like I said, like, you saw the season, you can kind of get the implication, but they don't say it out loud. And I just want to know why. Like, I just want to know, like, was it like that they didn't believe it, or like that a higher level person was like, you can't actually say that, because they let them say a lot during the season. So I don't know. It's very weird to me. And I was, yeah, disappointed. But yeah, the amount of weird new propaganda shows is insane. I am amazed. It's ridiculous. So yeah, that was a big gripe of me for something for 2021 that's really stuck around. Ariana, what was your big gripe of 2021?
My gripe of 2021 is just me being depressing, and I feel like it's very me specific, because this is definitely an issue that's always happened. But it's just that within the last year, and probably before that, but I feel like especially within the last year, you know, I joined social media. As you all know, I joined Twitter so that I could tweet to Glee Chat, even though you guys never tweeted me back. But
I didn't have control of the channel.
But, you know, I specifically joined social media so that I could engage with fandom and, you know, talk about my favorite shows and talk to my friends about my favorite shows and, you know, just to engage in fandom. And I feel like within the last year, it's just become, for me, not fun. Like the negatives outweigh the positives. And, you know, I feel like this is something that we've all gone through, especially like, you know, having written for Hypebole. You know, you post an article and yes, some people say nice things, but a lot of times people say, you know, racist things or sexist things or mean things. But I guess just I'm so tired now. I think that I'm just an old tired person, that the one mean thing is more than all of the nice things combined. And so I just find myself.
Yeah. Like 100 nice things and one cruel thing. Yeah. It's not a question.
So I just don't want to, like, I find myself, wanting to tweet something and just being like, you know what? It's not worth it. Like the engagement, like it's just not worth my energy for whatever may come. So I just lurk now. But yeah, I wish that fans knew how to engage with fandom in a healthy way. I know you feel this, Natalie, because you're in the depths of CW fandom.
I mean, I try to avoid it now. I've been way less on Twitter this year because it's so tiring. But yeah, it's definitely different.
Like, especially now, like working on a specific show, I try to like never say what the show is because some of those fans can be crazy and they'll do things like threaten your pet or do weird
what?
do weird things like that. So it's, yeah, I just wish fans could be normal. Like, just be normal.
No! I think for me, the heat has really come from the last, I guess, 2 years of isolation as well. Like, people have just, like, they don't know how to be normal, full stop. Like, they are not coping and acting out. And then there's, like, there's another issue, which is like the trickle down, whatever you want to call them, like antis or puritans, and you know, the youth that it's not all young people, but it's majority young people, majority under 18. It tended to originate in as a lot of tropes with fandoms, or like a lot of behaviors with fandoms often originate with anime fandoms that then trickle into Western fandoms. And that's not like a rule, but it is a thing. And it definitely has come to the behavior of people online, which is, you know, this very right and wrong, restrictive, moralistic, puritanical, controlling behavior about fandom, that, you know, if people like a certain thing or ship a certain thing, you know, that they are ethically unsound. These are the kind of kids who like write to the fan fiction websites like AO3 and like, you should ban all content of this specific type, whether that's like a age gap or like they genuinely feel like there's a real world corollary between like what you're interested in fandom and like whether you are causing harm and grooming minors, or like, you know, they get, there's also an attitude just even broader than that, that anyone over about the age of 25 who still like wants to talk about things in a fandom is like sick and wrong. And like, some of them have this gross attitude of like, oh my God, if I'm still caring about XYZ when I'm 25, girl, you know, I'll kill myself. Like, they in a way treat them, their own investment, as temporary and shameful. And it's just bizarre. With Supernatural, we've seen like a lot of kids come into the fandom, like new younger kids come in to a very established fandom and present this attitude, and the amount of kind of heat that's caused, I just basically can't deal with them anymore. Like, I love having conversations with people on Twitter about things, but you know, whether it's like a show that everyone's watching, I love like everyone talking about the same thing that's airing on TV, and I kind of like that with more like general audience fandoms, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But there's a lot going downhill in terms of like deep fandom culture that I don't know how to.
There's also just like this very bizarre, and I would say like immature.
Yeah.
It's immature way of like seeing fictional characters as like people who need to be protected.
Yeah,
but not seeing real life actual humans as people.
Like that they are so concerned about the harm that you are doing to a fictional character in your fan fiction for being in like a abusive relationship, whatever, that they will like dox you and tell you to kill yourself. Like, it's like, look, there's a lot of layers to it, and it's all bad. I, you know, I think the further we get away from spaces like forums where, you know, you're posting under a thread where everyone's allowed to talk about the thing, rather than like a social media page like Twitter or Tumblr, where you're not really talking in a communal space, you're just talking in your own space, and then someone talking to you is invading your space. Like, as opposed to a live journal community where, or a forum where, you know, there's a post like, hey, thoughts about this ship or what happened in this episode, and anyone who replies, they're all there under the umbrella together of the right to kind of speak in a communal space. And the issue with treating Twitter in general like that kind of communal space is that there's no filtering. It's not like, hey, I've gone on to the Supernatural forum and I've gone into the Dean and Cass positive thread and I've clicked on the post saying, hey, what did you think about their interactions in this episode? Where I've gone through several levels of consent and several levels of active seeking to talk with people about the things that I wanted to talk about. Whereas Twitter does not have that level. It's just like everything is being shouted at the same time in the same space with no like umbrella topics that mean that you're engaging with people that you know are going to take you in good faith. That's a big thing that you're not able to like control whether the people who see your tweets are going to engage with you in good faith or not, because you know, like if you're on a forum and like you're like clicked into the, you know, pro Dean Cass, what happened in episode 13, 20 or whatever, you know, and you're having that conversation, if some random from halfway across the internet chose to come into that thread and be like, you're wrong, this is fucked, it's so disgusting that you think this about them, they would be like reprimanded and removed from that room, from that thread, by an, you know, same like the mods of the forum or like someone who's got, you know, we've set a space with rules where you know we all want to have a good time and these rules help us have a good time, because if you don't have those opinions, don't come here and yell at the people that do have those opinions, you know. And that rule is allowed to exist, that, you know, if you come into this room and are a dick, you will be made to leave the room because this is a space for people who don't want to be a dick about that thing. Whereas just posting in the wild on social media has none of that control. And it's a real nightmare. Like it's horrible. And people don't respect the fact that I'm like, I only want to engage with this if we're talking about it in good faith. I've said that to people and people like do not think that is a valid request. They do not think it is valid to say that. So you post it in public, therefore anyone can say whatever they want about it. I hate that.
Yeah.
Sorry, it sucks.
It does suck. And I think so many people feed off of negativity these days. And that's something I really struggle with because, you know, like Thunder Force, okay, I really didn't like it. I did not go around bashing it on Twitter. I didn't seek out other people's, you know, enjoyment of it to tear it down. Why would I put that much energy into disliking this thing when I can use that energy to like something that I actually enjoyed? And I feel like these days, not only do you have people, you know, being anonymous on the computer and not really living with the consequences of their words and actions, but they're bored and they think the best thing to do, the most entertaining thing to do, is to tear people down. And I'll never understand that. I don't get the point of putting that much energy into hating something.
It's also not just the hating, it's the control. It's the, like, you can't like this other thing. And I struggle with this because that section of people, like the Puritan kind of people, and I always say this and, you know, I don't really like to defend them, but, like, they're coming from a place of, they think, and I've said this before, they think they're coming from a place of minimizing harm. They think that they are coming from a place of trying to make everyone feel safe and all of that. But it's completely twisted, you know, saying you deserve to be bullied, kill yourself for having this thing in fiction that you like that's problematic. Like the Hannibal, huge issues that went down, you know, over the last couple of years with young fans attacking Brian Fuller of Hannibal about his thoughts about the show, like at all of that kind of thing, which is just bizarre because I'm like, you're a child, this is a show about
show about cannibal.
And yeah, and they're like, you're...
What, the
you're,
ethics of cannibalism? Like,
yeah, this is where it really falls apart when you poke at it, because it's demented. But yeah, it's not great. And, you know, and then you see kids being like young kids, you know, this is, you know, people who are often like 15, 16, 17, you know, getting up to their early 20s. You know, and then you kind of see once in a while you see someone going and on and you're like, oh, I've changed, you know, my mind. I now understand that, you know, it's not that bad. You know, a lot of how I acted was because I felt pressured by the other people in the community, like that this is the only way to be like morally correct. Like I was having to suppress my own interests because I was scared of being part of their witch hunt. You know, like it's witch hunt is a good way to put it, and it's really bad. And it's not just happening in fandom, it all just happens in a lot of queer spaces in general, like a lot of young people really pulling this kind of behavior with any kind of queer culture, any term like terminology. There's a lot of it that's like a trickle down of you know, from Tumblr about from TERFs, like from TERF grooming, being like that they don't know is TERF grooming, but basically this feeding of these like rights and wrong way to be or to, you know, think about sexualities. And I can see it getting worse, and I just hate it. So yeah, I don't love that. Yeah, I guess I've started a lot of group chats, like to talk about various shows and stuff with, like, you know, the same five people. What happens now is, like, I make the same five people watch all the shows that I watch and then talk to them about it in private. But I like talking to people, so it sucks. Like, are there things, you know, I don't see you on Twitter that much, Ariana. Do you, like, lurk a lot of opinions about the shows you're watching and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I love lurking and reading other people's opinions.
Yeah.
And I love seeing like other people tweet about fandom stuff. But I don't have the energy for it.
Put your opinions out there in the world.
Yeah. Maybe I should make like a private account where.
I have to say that I really like TikTok, probably more than I should. But one of the good things about TikTok, and there are plenty of bad things, is that the algorithm is so good that I don't really see a lot of hateful things on TikTok. Oh. Like
a lot of this problem is coming from TikTok. Like a lot of this fan.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of this attitude problem is
coming. Yeah, from yeah. And I was going to mention that earlier. Yeah. Because
I don't have TikTok. I'll watch one if someone sends it to me, but I can't be doing it.
Yeah. But I will say that my For You page tends to be a very positive place because those are the videos that I interact with. Not saying you would never run into anything negative, but I have enjoyed finding new people with similar opinions to mine where I can just basically lurk too, because I don't make my own TikToks, but I like, you know, watching other people enjoy the things that I enjoy. And TikTok's algorithm is very, very scary in how accurate it is. So yeah. That's an option if you want to risk some of that negativity coming onto your For You page.
I was trying to think, because I too have really just stopped going on Twitter. Like, I open it out of like muscle memory habit, but always just immediately click the home button and it takes me to the top. And if the first two tweets
used
don't
to
interest
read my
me,
feed and then
but I was wondering, like, as we were talking, I was just like, but I don't feel particularly disengaged. And it wasn't until you said, I just make people watch things and then make a group chat about it, I was like, ah, that's why I do not feel disengaged. Because anytime I need to talk about something that I've watched, I've talked about it in a group chat instead of on Twitter or anywhere. I guess it's just Twitter, because I deleted Facebook this year, which was the best thing I ever did. And yeah, I don't really miss it. If there's something that I watched that I feel particularly I want to know what certain people think about it, I just go to the writers that I like and find them, or do like a quick little, I scroll a little bit more in depth around the topic. The only thing that I really still like to engage with, and I find myself on social media the most during is football, because I just like football Twitter, but that's like everybody's saying the same exact thing. There are just writers that I follow that I like. There are podcasters for football that I like that I follow. And I like a good meme that's made out of like a player doing something. So that's really the only time I find myself like actively on social, like, well, I go on Instagram a lot, but on like Twitter for an extended period of time now is just when I'm watching football.
Fair enough. Ariana, do you talk to people at all about things?
Oh yeah. I mean, I talk to lots of people. So I also don't feel like, I wouldn't say I feel disengaged either. I have my ways. I talk in messages or real life or, you know, to people about the shows that I care about. I don't know. I don't quite, I guess I'm just annoyed at fans.
That's fair.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, look, be the change you want to see in the world, I guess. I don't even know. I'm kind of enjoying like having conversations, like when I have them very occasionally, with things that have like shows that have more of like a general audience, I guess, these days, like rather than engaging with like stans. This might be a good segue into my hype. You know, going into hypes, my hype for 2021 is Ted Lasso in a variety of ways, which I'll get into. But given that we're just talking about social media, I have found that because that's such a popular show for like a, I guess, like a wider audience, like not necessarily like a fandom focused audience, though there is a fandom, that shows like that, or like shows where it's like an appointment television, like everyone's talking about Loki or Hawkeye, or even when Only Murders in the Building was airing, I kind of enjoyed seeing more, now that like more people who aren't fandomy are on social media and are talking about shows, I kind of enjoy those conversations with people who are clearly more generally engaged rather than like really manic fandom level engagement like Supernatural. So I actually have really enjoyed like having a few back and forths with people this year about Ted Lasso. On Tumblr, there's quite an active fandom for Ted Lasso. It's not big, it's very small, but you know, I've had a couple, you know, just replying to people's posts, and then they've inboxed me and just had like random kind of like this, like skip the small talk, like chats, like immediately about like a character trait or something like that. So, you know, I have hopes. You know, I think it depends on the property as well. That being said, I'm already seeing some patterns with Ted Lasso fandom in terms of like either people who've come to that fandom because they do fandom, quote unquote, for everything that they engage with. So they're like old school fandom kind of veterans, or people who've never done fandom and this is the first show that they've thought about for more than 5 minutes and it's got under their skin. And the juxtaposition between those posts is quite annoying. But I can see a few dramas like just about burning to happen. But in general, at the moment, enjoying the level of engagement with those fans, though I am planning a Ted Lasso article that I know is going to piss people off, or at least in that department. So I'm kind of already braced for that. I'm braced for like the 5 people on Tumblr who I know are going to be really angry. But my hype for 2021 is Ted Lasso, the show and everything about it. I started watching the show back in about March, maybe, like the first season. We got a free trial of Apple TV Plus, like with an Apple device. And, you know, I'd kind of heard about, I can't remember where I heard about it. Like, you know, it was just sort of getting a bit of buzz. And as soon as we got the Apple Plus free trial, we watched it and I could not like believe how good it was. Like we were stretching it out, like saving like one episode a day at lunchtime or whatever. And then season 2 came out in August or early September, and that was even better. So following that live week to week, like I think it got a lot of hype over the American Summer, like a lot of people started watching it a bit after I did, like in, you know, June, July, I think, like when Jason Sudeikis won the Golden Globe, a lot of people started watching it in the summer. And so watching it week to week was really interesting and really enjoyable for me. Yeah, it's been a very overwhelming experience with a property for me. It's just a really complexly drawn show. So basically every scene, every character in every scene, like I could talk about for a very long time because it just has a lot of depth right from the start. That it was a show where they knew they were going to do three seasons from the start, and they had these end points for the characters, and, you know, all of the actors know, like, their story, and they know the inner life of the character that's making them act the way they do early on. And it's just really, really amazing in that element. You know, I love the premise. I love sports movies. I love British comedy, and it really is a British comedy despite being, like, run by an American. It really combines that culture clash really well, but it does more lean towards the British side of comedy and pacing and stuff like that. Ultimately, like, it's a show about trauma, which is always really interesting to me, like the it's primarily a show about trauma and how that affects people and how people act in spite of it or because of it. You wouldn't have thought that they'd got that from the original ads that Jason Sudeikis made about the you know, the joke ads about being a hopeless American football coach coaching British Premier League football or soccer. But, yeah, it's a big deal. Brittany has heard way too much about this from me already and has not watched it. I think that she feels bullied and will never watch it because of the amount that I've asked her to watch it. But no, yeah,
I have 10 days off.
I haven't thought about another show so much in years, like years and years and years. You know, I remember when we started watching Schitt's Creek, Ariana, you said at one point, like, that they're writing these characters like they've got 20 years with them. And I feel that probably even stronger on Ted Lasso in terms of fully drawn character work.
That's so interesting. That's from what I've seen on social media as I lurk. That seems to be the biggest comparison.
Yeah.
To it is Schitt's Creek.
I don't know if I feel like it's like Schitt's Creek. I feel like people take away something similar from it because it's people trying to treat each other well, I guess, and that would be the biggest comparison. It's like people actively trying to treat each other well. I think that the assessment of Ted Lasso as like a fluffy feel-good show is not accurate, and that's something that the executive producers also think is not accurate. Like, people have conflated the fact that Ted himself is like a cheerful, you know, a happy-go-lucky person, and the fact that people treat each other well or try to treat each other well with the idea that the show is a feel-good show. And I think it's a lot more complicated than that. I think, you know, the fly in that ointment is Ted, because as they like to say, like, yeah, he's this kind of American who's acting like super positive to everyone around him. But why has this man taken this job in the UK? Because he's separated from his wife. Like, he's left his wife and his 8-year-old son in Kansas to take this job in London. He's running away. That's day one. Like, in the pilot, you get that information. And so I think that there's like casual viewers of Ted Lasso who don't really like get it. But I think that the amount of people that watch it and do get it is a large percentage. I think that it's engaging a lot of people who don't necessarily engage with shows on a fandom level, like genre fans, you know, like, cause a lot of fandom is genre shows, right? And so I feel like this is engaging more just general TV people, general people who like TV, to think hard about the characters. Like, you cannot help thinking hard about the emotional implications and the reveals. Even my dad, like, was like talking to me, like, last time I went, like, my dad has never spoken to me about television in ever. Like, he just doesn't get it on that level at all. And my dad and my stepmother, I was like, you should watch this show that you really like, because they have been asking for recommendations in the last year. And they were talking to me, like, when I was there last time about, like, Brett Goldstein's performance as Roy and about, you know, finding out the way that Jamie acted in season one is, you know, due to the abuse of his father and, like, stuff like that. Like, my parents, like, do not speak to me about television, but they are just, you just watch it and it just, I don't want to say it spoon feeds you this because it doesn't, but I did write an article about how it's predictable in a good way in that it telegraphs a lot of things. It basically, like, almost from the word go, it telegraphs nearly everything that you would want to know or everything that's kind of driving the characters from day one. It's telegraphed in a very subtle but very clear way so that when various reveals happen, they feel fulfilling and satisfying because you kind of were getting there yourself, or, like, they're saying, yes, you know, he feels this way because of this or whatever. And that's, like, most important with Ted, the lead character, and his behavior. I love Ted himself because he's, like, a full Slytherin. He's radically positive. Like, when I say radical positivity, I mean, like, as a choice, like, as an action, as a manipulation tactic. He's incredibly manipulative in a way that I love, in that he knows the ways that he approaches people, even if they're grumpy about it at first. He knows that if he just, like, leaves it on the table, he gets these results. Like, he knows how to use his persona to get the results that he wants for the greater good. And it's for good reasons. It's for, you know, lifting people up. But it's not like, oh, he's so bumbling, you can't help love him, or he's so cheerful. It's very intentional for the character, and everything in the show is very intentional. But Ted is a very intentionally manipulative person with his radical positivity. It's a fascinating character, and every character's fascinating. I've, you know, already spoken on this podcast a couple of weeks ago about Jamie, my favorite character. I think that, you know, both the lead female characters are amazing, and yeah, I just love everything about it. And because it is so fully drawn, I'm, like, constantly always thinking about it, or, like, discovering new things, like, in, even if it's in, like, the gifts of, like, background of scene, oh, like, that person was hugging that person and that's so cute compared to this. Like, even just recently, I know you've seen the show, Karen, Brittany and Ariana haven't.
Right.
Recently, you know, I was kind of like, you know, I saw a moment that I'd never noticed before, which is that in episode 104, which is, like, the charity benefit, because I saw something, an interview with Taheeb, who plays Sam, talking about his relationship with Jamie and saying, like, in season one, he'd wanted to be friends with him. And I'm like, did he, I didn't really get that the first time. And recently I saw a gif of that benefit and, you know, they're all going to dance on the dance floor, and Sam goes and he tries to pull Jamie up and bring him to the dance floor, and Jamie, like, shrugs him off. And it's, like, in the background of a scene, but, like, there's just a lot of constant implications, and it's a show where pretty much every tiny implication will matter in a way that, for me, as someone who, like, really pays attention to tiny implications, there's been a lot of things that I knew was coming because I was like, oh, that I got that implication. But then you get people who are more casual viewers who didn't get that implication, but then they rewatch it, or they feel, like, amazed, like, in a good way. They're like, oh, my God, that was there the whole time. And I'm like, yeah, it was there the whole time. I know how to watch television. But people who don't really, like, engage that closely are really excited by the depth of the show, because it's, like, steps up ahead of things that are kind of more messy and not as intentional. And I'm engaging with it really strongly in a fandom way. Like, it's one of the only shows in years that's made me want to spend more time in the world of them by reading fan fiction. And one of my best friends of, like, 15 years, who I've always been in fandoms with and read fan fiction with, is writing fan fiction for the show. She's never written fan fiction before, and I've, like, been, like, helping her write fiction. I don't generally write fiction. I'm enjoying helping edit her, and I think she's really good. And so it's, like, another level of fandom engagement for me that I've never had before, which is actually in writing fan fiction. I have spent more minutes thinking about this show this year than anything else. So there's absolutely nothing else that could be a hype for me for 2021. It is, I have not gone more than a few hours this year without thinking about the show. So yeah, it's a really big deal. And I really hope you guys like it if you watch it. I've watched it through a few times. I'm about to start another rewatch of it. Obviously, I love the entire cast, and I really hope to do press with them next year for season three. For season two, they did press with a large variety of large and small outlets, like YouTube channels with 1,000 subscribers, huge interviews with big places. Like, they really varied, so I'd really love to speak to some of them. I recently published a couple of interviews I did with one of the guest stars, who's a big fan favorite, James Lance, who plays the journalist Trent Crim, who is one of the people who covers the team. He's kind of like someone who becomes an ally of Ted, and he's going to have a bigger role in season three. And yeah, recently, you know, have loved discovering like the cast's older work. Like, I just published an article about the superhero comedy movie that Brett Goldstein, he made that movie in 2015, or put that movie out in 2015. And
yeah, you did. And he retweeted it.
Oh yeah. He is a very nice man, and I am a big fan of him and his prior, you know, he's a stand-up, and I love British stand-up, and he has a fascinating story. He was hired onto that show as a writer, not as an actor, and when they finished writing the season, he'd become so in tune and attached to Roy that he was like, I think I want to play him. I don't think that they are going to consider me appropriate, but I am just going to send in a tape because, look, I feel like he's mine. And they gave it to him, and he got the Emmy for it. So it's like, that is amazing to me, and he's really cool. He's got like the most amazing podcast. It's so much better than this podcast. It's he has like the best, most evergreen idea for a podcast I've ever seen, and I'm so jealous of it. And he's been running that since well before the show. It's called Films to Be Buried With. It's like every week he gets a guest, and like, you know, his guests used to be like fellow tiny British comedians, and now his guests are like really big Hollywood people, because everyone who sees the show is in love with him, and they all want to, you know, he did like Barry Jenkins. He's done like huge names now, where he basically gets people on and he says, okay, you've died. I want to learn about your life story through the films that have meant the most to you. You know, whether it's the first film that you remember, you know, the saddest film you've ever seen, the film that means the most to you because of the circumstances that you saw it in, you know, the objectively what you think is the best film of all time. If aliens came and you're like, what's the best film? What is a film? And it's the same series of questions, but it is like the most interesting and personal introspection for the guest. Like, I want every single person that I've ever been a fan of to be a guest on this show and tell their story, because it's so good. And he's such a good host. And yeah, I basically love everyone involved in the show, and whether it's been about the show itself, fan fiction, talking to other friends about like character traits of characters, you know, talking to people on Tumblr, doing interviews. I have not stopped thinking about this show all year since March, and it is my 2021. And yeah. Yeah, and I'm still not sick of it. I'm still, every day I go on and I talk a little Ted Lasso chat about things about particular characters that we've probably already talked about 5,000 times, but we've had like new ideas about, because like it's everything. It's like down to like characters, the way characters like move their hands in prior episodes that like in retrospect, you know, after seeing season two, paint a picture for what was being implied in season one. It's so careful, and there's definitely stuff in season two that's going to land in season three. And right now I'm like, we don't know what those things might be. So it's very, very exciting. Sorry, that was like very passionate, but this has been my life for the year. It's been like the only truly good thing. Karen, did you catch up with all of season two?
Yes. Yeah.
How do you feel about it? I know everyone loves it. Like, everyone who's seen it loves it.
Yeah.
Like, obviously I'm like constantly like about it.
Yeah. I really, really love it. Kristen saw it before me, and kind of, this was sort of when it first came out. Like, people were obviously talking about it, but I kind of saw what it was about. I also love sports movies. Like, for not being very much a sports person, yeah, sports movies are my jam. And I was like, okay, this looks like it could be pretty good, and ended up watching it and immediately fell in love with it, and have also been trying to get a bunch of people to watch it because I think that it lands, it would land with so many different kinds of people. And it's, for me, it gives me the same feeling that The Good Place gave me. Not to say that they're, you know, super similar shows, but yeah, it makes me feel good about being alive. It yeah, makes me feel good about humanity. And I completely agree with everything you said. And I think that it's really fascinating to talk about Ted's radical positivity and his manipulations and stuff. And, you know, whether people agree with that or not, whatever, like, I like him as the lead character and the way that he interacts with everybody, but particularly with other men. And I think that
yeah,
this shows
yeah,
the way that the men are emotional with each other in this show. Just, I haven't seen that a lot in places. Yeah. And Roy is hands down my all-time favorite. I love him so much. And I've only seen the show twice. I think I've seen season one twice, and I've only seen season two once. But I need to rewatch it because there's so much meat to it, despite it being a fairly short and like kind of straightforward show. There's just yeah, so much to constantly think about.
I think one of the things that's the most interesting to me is the, and I think they've talked about this bit, is the implications, you know, I feel like this is, it's almost like, I feel like all shows should do this, but they don't, which is that, like, when things are not on screen, when things are not actually on screen, they're still happening. Like you have implications of what someone's whole life story might have been because of how they act. And, you know, you've got all these implications that, like, if the show says this in a throwaway line, like to imply something about someone, you know, logistically it means this must have happened to them and, you know, this would have been their backstory, you know, whether it's like, you know, anything about, like, you know, the history of Roy's career as a footballer or Keely's career as a, like a Page Three model, you know, Rebecca and her divorce and, you know, Nate, you know, how the hell did Nate even get that job? Like, there's like a kind of all of these like questions. Basically what they have said is if you have asked a question about the implication of something in the show, even if it's throwaway, the writers have said, you can almost guarantee that they are completely aware of that and that they're on top of it. Like, one thing that I really am curious about is like Roy and Jamie's backstory from before Ted got there. Obviously very early on, they kind of have that, you know, they have extreme clashing. But then even early on in the series, you see Jamie say that Roy was his childhood hero, like that he was one of the players that he had a poster of on his wall as a kid before he became before he was signed. And so I'm like, what was that first meeting like when Jamie gets transferred to Richmond on loan? Is he expecting to, like, did he act arrogant, but like kind of like trying to get in with Roy, like, you know, and Roy rejected him? Like, is all this behavior him acting out against his hero, dismissing him and belittling him? Because then in season two, all he wants to do is please Roy. So it's like that kind of implication of like the psychology of these people's backstories. And every character that has like a big part, like the eight leads and then about three or four other kind of recurring leads, they all have these implications of like their life basically and how they've gotten to the behavior that they are currently showing. It's very interesting. And I think it's really important that there are three of the male leads are also writers on the show. And apparently they do a lot of, so and that's Jason, obviously, Brendan, who plays Coach Beard, and Brett, who plays Roy. And apparently, like, on the day, they're pretty much like, Hannah in an interview recently was like, you know, oh, just, it was so shocking for me. Hannah Waddingham, who plays Rebecca, You know, she's done a lot of stuff on stage and on screen. And, you know, she said it was so shocking to me the way that they push me, like, because Jason and Brett will be up against a wall, like writing new sides, like literally, you know, 10 minutes before the filming, they'll be writing new sides in handwritten up against a wall and handed to me and be like, do it like this. And that level of, like, you know, because Jason comes from improv, like, you know, Saturday Night Live, and Brett's stand up. And that level of kind of like in the moment, you know, just feel it, just do it and feel it, was really challenging for her, but she liked it, like, you know, liked being pushed to that. She just wasn't like how she'd ever done things. And there's a lot of passion behind how it's made and a lot of psychology behind how it's made. And it's just doing the right things. It comes from the right place. They're constantly quoting Brené Brown. I mean, I don't know what else you could say. Like, everyone on the cast is amazing. Like, they seem to have hired a group of people who are all just the right kind of, like, extra good, extra thoughtful people. And it's just so good. Sorry, I've just gone on about this. Roy in season one was definitely my favorite. In season two, it's definitely Jamie that's retroactively then made him my favorite of the show. I don't think Roy has quite as much to do in season two as he should have, but I do think season three, I'll say now, I'm going to make a prediction for the end of the series, which I think the series has to end with Ted leaving, because I think that the entire point of the show, you know, the show is in a large way about, like, the trauma of fatherhood, like fathers and sons, is a hugely important theme of the show. And they are neglecting, well, not neglecting, I think it's intentional. Ted is neglecting to face the fact that he has left his 8-year-old child behind, and he is, you know, now this absent father to a child, in order to have taken this job in London to get away from his wife. And I think the show will end with him going back to Kansas to father his child, like, to parent his child, and that Roy will become the manager of Richmond. So I don't know. It should be interesting. But, yeah, it's a great show, and everyone should watch it, no matter what kind of television you think that you like. Just watch it and pay attention. It's weird. Apple is like, Apple TV Plus is, it's a weird platform, but it's making some really good stuff.
Speaking of.
Segue. Yeah.
Please let me tell you about Mythic Quest.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody here seen Mythic Quest?
I have seen season one. I haven't seen the next season yet, but I'm okay. Familiar with it. Yeah.
Anybody else?
No.
Okay.
I don't have Apple TV.
I know, I'm too cheap to get it, but I need to. Sorry. Tell me why I need it, Karen.
Okay. All right. So, Mythic Quest, basically, so as you guys know, like, comedies aren't really my thing. I've been watching a lot more comedies lately because my boyfriend loves comedies, and he keeps finding these ones that I end up loving, and I hate it, and it makes me so mad.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
When you say you don't like comedy, do you mean you don't like American comedy, or do you just don't like, what is it about comedy that you don't like? Because I feel like there's such a range of comedy, and, you know, for example, Ted Lasso is a comedy, but it's like,
right,
mainly about trauma and pain. Mythic Quest is a very painful show as well. Yeah. So like, is it like you don't like slapstick silly, like you don't like sitcom-y stuff? Because most comedy is about pain.
Yeah. I guess that is a very general statement. Obviously, there are some comedies that I do like. I tend to shy away from them because I don't think they're very funny most of the time. And I think, like, mean comedy is not my jam at all. And I feel like for at least a while there, especially, you know, maybe a decade or so ago, like, that was all I felt like there was, a lot of, you know, punching down on things. And that just always really bothered me. All the stand-ups that I really liked were people who were either, you know, self-deprecating or kind of did the type of comedy that made me feel welcome. And there are still quite a few comedies that I don't particularly like. Which is actually funny.
Call them out, Karen.
Well, it's funny because so Mythic Quest was made by Rob McElhenney, Charlie Day, and Megan Gantz, who all also made It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Now,
I hate It's Always Sunny.
Yeah,
sorry, so likes it. I find it horrible.
So this is the thing. Kevin was basically like, okay, Mythic Quest is about video games. It has like Poppy, the main character, is this like kind of neurotic, but like really smart woman in gaming and coding and everything. There are lesbians. You're going to like it. And I was like, all right, that does sound like something I would enjoy. And it ended up being really, really lovely. And then we started watching It's Always Sunny. And I don't know what it is about the show, because I don't like it, but I don't dislike it, because you're meant to hate them. Yeah. Like you're meant to understand that they are terrible people and the things that they do, which are racist and homophobic and like all of those other things, you're not meant to support it. So I like always have this huge deep sigh after every episode because it makes me so mad, but you're not meant to agree with them. And it's such a weird, like a weird in between kind of comedy that normally I wouldn't go toward, but there's just something about it that, you know, I would rather watch other things, but I've seen enough episodes of it that I'm like, okay, I kind of understand what they're getting for. And I actually read an article like a week or two ago, because I went down this rabbit hole. I was like, why do I enjoy this show, even though it makes me mad? And there was like a woman of color wrote an article about how this show should have gotten canceled and probably couldn't have been made today, but how you're never meant to see them as people that you should look up to, or you're never supposed to endorse who they are. It's cathartic in the way that you're meant to dislike them.
I get that. I just don't want to spend time with those people.
Yeah. And that's totally fair. I have to do it in small chunks. And there are parts of it that I like. I think Charlie Day is like a very talented person. And his character is probably my favorite.
I mean, I do have friends that love it, and I really respect them for, like, you know, making queer jokes about a character from 12 seasons and then actually being like, yeah, actually, yeah, I am. And just like playing that totally straight. So I respect them for that. But
I actually remembered that, like, when it happened. And I remember you talking about it specifically. And I told him I wanted to watch that episode. And the episode is ridiculous, but it is sort of like they've also done some other very bad, like they've done blackface and stuff on the show and have gone back to basically fix that. Yeah. And the creators have talked about things that they regret doing. And I think it's a very honest show in that, you know, it admits when it does make mistakes, but it also doesn't like pull its punches. It's confusing and it's not going to be for everybody. I'm not even sure it's for me. That aside, Mythic Quest is great and you should watch it. I really like this show. I think so. Rob McElhenney plays Ian, the main character, and he is ridiculous. He's a narcissist. He's so vain and insane. But he cares about people. He cares about the people that he surrounds himself with. So there's that like redeeming quality to it. Poppy is this very neurotic woman who is very good at her job and isn't afraid to sort of like be herself and put her foot down and be the girl boss, even when people don't really respect her. And there's just other smaller characters in there, characters that I don't particularly like, but still have like empathy for. And I feel like that's where you can kind of feel a little bit of Always Sunny in there, but they do a really good job of making it feel like everybody has multiple dimensions. There's a character named Joe who's an assistant for a few different characters throughout both seasons. She's a lot. She's very, very, she loves power. She's obsessed with power. And so she will flip between anybody who has power in any given moment. And she's a very scary, angry person. But they even found ways to make you care about her. And those are the kind of shows that I find really interesting because, like, I was ready to write her off. She was my least favorite part of the show. And then in season two, I kind of like understood her better and it made me feel things. Then I got mad because they did a good job at what they were doing. But I love the show for so many different reasons because I really love video games and they make the video game a part of the story in terms of like you actually get cutscenes with it sometimes. And it's not just like an office drama kind of thing. Like they talk about the actual video game and it always makes me want to play video games. Like it's very realistic, I think, in terms of how people interact with video games and that whole culture and world. But my two favorite episodes of this show came out in the pandemic. They did one that was called Quarantine, where it basically showed all of them working from home. And like the cast actually did a Zoom call together as their characters to put together this episode. And it really highlights, I watched that this year and that came out last year, and it really highlights what it felt like in the middle of the pandemic. So like for some people, you don't really want to think about that anymore. And that's totally fair, but it immediately brought me back to like that kind of isolation that we felt. And I think it was done really well in that this show is also a comedy, but it really hits you with emotional gut punches sometimes. And I love shows that can balance those sort of things, kind of like Ted Lasso, where like it can be really funny and ridiculous and silly and also very heavy at the same time. And if you can bounce between those two things, then you have gold on your hands. But the other episode, Everlight, which like we're putting out some Subjectify articles and like definitely I wrote about Mythic Quest and about Everlight. They did an episode. It was a standalone episode that they put out this year, another pandemic episode where the office basically celebrates a holiday within the game called Everlight. And they put on a pretend tournament. And it's about them, you know, trying to figure out who's going to win this tournament. And there's a whole like situation with a character named Brad, who's like awful, but I also ended up caring about him. And
that's Danny Pudi, right?
Yes. Yeah. And they had, what's his face? Anthony Hopkins narrated like the animation for the beginning of the episode. Yeah, I was like, wait a second. It was a very good surprise. And they ended up like, I don't know if they saved all of their CGI budget for this episode, but they ended up like the characters didn't go into the game, but they imagined themselves in the game and it came with like actual CGI of magic and stuff. And it was so well done and it was so rewarding. And these characters that you really come to care about, even when you dislike them, you see kind of the best parts of them and also why everybody kind of fits into the story that the way that they do. And I cried a lot during this episode for no reason other than it was just really like heartwarming. And I just think that it's a show that if people gave it a chance, they would find something to like about it.
My favorite episode so far, I haven't seen season two, is something that I think the show is definitely worth praising for and definitely like something that I wish other shows would do, which is standalone episodes within the universe of the show. Yes. That aren't necessarily about the main characters. So in season one, there's an episode called A Dark, Quiet Death, and it's it does not feature the main characters. It features the entire life cycle of a game. Basically, earlier in the season, you see, like, they're at a gaming convention, and you see, like, this, like, character that's, like, a logo for a game. Like, he's, like, a little guy. He's, like, a logo for a game that everyone is like, oh, this is a, you know, one of a cute, lovable thing. And then, like, two episodes later, you get this complete standalone episode. It does not focus on the leads. It basically involves these two people meeting in a game shop in, like, the 90s, I think. And it's Jake Johnson and Kristen Milioti, and they are both so good in this episode. Like, just, they are so good. It's so sad. And it basically tracks about 15 or 20 years of their life, of them getting together and developing this really unusual video game, and the life cycle of how that game, you know, is what they want, and then how, you know, how it gets commercialized, and basically, you know, how their relationship goes and doesn't go, and just basically this tracking of, you know, a decade to two decades of their career, and from their original artistic idea through to what ends up being how it all gets bastardized and resulted in this little fluffy character that you saw in the prior episodes. And then I think at the end of the episode, like, you know, the point of entry is that you're watching it with, you know, them going to this producer, like them trying to get funding, the company, the big money and the production company, they're trying to sell their idea to this production company. And then the end of the very end of the episode is Iron coming into the same production company and trying to sell Mythic Quest, basically. Like, so, you know, like, it's just another example of, like, how the game, you know, a game would rise and fall or become, like, what you wanted it to be, and, you know, kind of this implication that, like, Iron, you know, and Mythic Quest is, like, they're still right in the peak of the game being exactly what they wanted it to be with the control that they have, but, you know, maybe one day it won't be, and, like, the things, you know, that they love about it will be commercialized out. Then in season two, I haven't seen it yet, but there's an episode that's a period drama episode flashback that is about the writer of the game, because they have basically like a story writer, like a book writer, who is a old, not very successful, like formerly award-winning but kind of old and tired sci-fi writer who Iron really liked, and he basically got him to come in and help like do story stuff for the game. And there's a cool episode in season one that deals with one of the testers kind of dealing with the writer and her not really understanding like why the story element was important, and him kind of not really having actually played the game and just only had the idea of the fantasy story in his head, and them working together and the tester understanding like why the story made gaming matter more. I'm not a gamer, and I have never experienced like important story in game. I have a lot of trouble believing that it is as impactful as people say it is, but the show is definitely trying to tell you that it is. And in season two, there's a flashback episode about like his young life, like how he became who he is. And that both the season one episode about, you know, another gamer set in the same, you know, game developer in the same universe, and then season two, the flashback episode about the writer, they are both like perfect, unusual episodes that I wish every single show did episodes, like not like exactly like that, but like I would love to see a Ted Lasso episode that dealt with like the history of Richmond over the years from the perspective of like May the bartender, for example, Karen, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, or like something that dealt with, yeah, like you flashback to like a childhood episode about how all of the players got like, you know, you get 13-year-olds and you get like, you do like how Roy was signed, like how Roy was scouted and how Jamie was scouted, and what, you know, different tracks of like how they, those kids, like how the British Premier League works with scouting kids and how they put them in schools or like take them, you know, like how they train them at like the football academies and stuff. And like maybe that would be boring to other people, but I would love that kind of stuff. Like, you know,
I also love episodes like that. And I think it's funny because Kevin, like, that episode came on. He's like, this is my least favorite episode. And we watched it.
The Dark Quiet Death or the Flashback?
Yeah.
Really? I think it's the best episode in season one.
I really loved it. I think for him, it was just that it didn't go with the rest of the story. Like, as much, like, there is a little bit of a tie-in, but it's not really part of the plot. But I really like the idea of filling out universes with other stories that are even just loosely connected and to the main plot.
Like, a whole story, like, as well. It's a creative challenge.
Yeah.
I cried in that episode.
It was just really well acted, really well written. You know who's guest starring in the season two?
Yeah, Shelley.
Yeah. Shelley Hunnig is in it. Beautiful and wonderful, and I think you're really going to enjoy that episode too.
Yeah, I don't know, because I'm not a gamer, so I was like, really? But I do.
That's good that you still like the story despite it being
I definitely, it's just another and that's it's just a really interesting show. I did hear a lot of hype about the pandemic episodes as well, so
they're so good.
So yeah, big up from Apple TV Plus over here.
Yeah.
I've heard a few shows that have got a really good, like Foundation, I've heard is really good. So
they can sponsor us if they want to.
Yeah. I definitely would be keen to have a look at what else they have coming out, because it's not a very, their UX is not great on Apple Plus. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's quite a difficult platform. Like, to actually, they need a bit of a smoother layout, but the content of what they're making is really, really good. I'm shocked. I wish there weren't so many streaming services. So if you can find someone to like share with, because Apple was giving out like free subscription. If you got a new Apple phone or a computer or whatever, in the last year, they had a free, it came with a free trial of a year, like a year's free access to Apple TV Plus. And so we've been going off that, and I will probably be keeping on paying for it when it runs out, or trying to find someone to go halves with, because it's really good. They're like, they make really good stuff. Sorry, that was a lot.
It was a lot.
It sounded like shills for Apple. Cool. Who wants to go next?
I can go next because I feel like it's on theme.
Cool.
Sort of. But you guys were talking about just like one-off episodes, and one of my shows has a one-off episode. So
cool.
But my hype for 2021 is the coming of age portrayals of teen girls on TV. And that's just my excuse to be able to talk about both Pen 15 and Never Have I Ever, which I've already gushed about here on Weather before. But I just feel like both of these shows do such an incredible job of showing like the messiness and beauty of teen girl rage. And that's, I feel like, the time of your life when you're at your most passionate. And so it's such a dynamic time, and they do such an incredible job of showing why these qualities that are so often seen as negative, at least in the past by media, and also, you know, when you're going through them, they feel like negative emotions, the positives and beauty of them. I think they do a really good job, and I'm just so in awe of both of these shows, like how Never Have I Ever, I feel like, nailed its second season after having a perfect first season, which is so hard to do. And I don't know if any of you have seen Pen 15 here, but they just finished their series, and it's kind of a three-part, they kind of did it in three acts, their show, and it's just such a perfectly arced conclusion, which they were able to pull off even though they were new moms in the middle of a pandemic. So kudos to them.
I have not seen that. Is that one where they act adults in the high school environment. Like they are playing themselves at 13, but they're adults.
Yes. So they are 30-year-old women. I think they're a little older now, but they start off as 30-year-old women playing 13-year-olds. And so that's the shtick, is that they're playing 13 and they're surrounded by actual 13-year-olds. And I know it's definitely not for everyone. Some people are like, it creeps me out, but I thought it would creep me out. But they're so good, these two women, at playing 13. I feel like I at least like instantly forgot. They mold into these teenagers. And because it does such a weird thing to your mind. Like as I'm watching them, I fully believe that they're 13-year-old girls, but also because I see them, I see what they look like. And I also know that they're women. There's just enough distance to add the comedy. Like you still have, it's like looking at yourself. It's like you're experiencing it yourself because you know, like, this stuff, some of the stuff they go through is traumatic and some of it feels like the end of the world, but you also see them as grown women and you're like, they're going to be okay. Like they're going to get through this and they're going to be okay at the end. and it's such a weird, like it's a very high concept thing, right? Like that's the shtick that women playing teenagers, but it is a very moving show. Like it's a true dramedy. It's obviously very funny, but it deals with very serious stuff, especially this last season that they just had.
I don't know when, like which season this episode was in, but when I was doing research for our animated episodes article, I saw, like I read up a little bit on them introducing animation in one of the episodes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was basically like, I think the premise was they go to like the boardwalk or something and a caricature artist draws a picture of them and basically accentuates the parts of them that they feel self-conscious about. And then it kind of like folds animation into there. And I had heard about the show kind of in passing, like when it first came out, I think because of the concept of like the 30-year-old women playing teenagers, which by the way, even if you just look at them, like not actually watching the show, I believe that they're like 13-year-old girls. Like it's really weird how they end up pulling that off. But, I was sort of interested in the show, haven't watched it all yet, but that episode in and of itself, I just thought it sounded so clever and so interesting and something that would probably really like emotionally impact me in terms of, you know, being self-conscious about your body and being afraid of how other people view you and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a really great episode. I do think it's their weakest episode just because it is animated, shockingly, because so much of the magic is watching them get to act. But yeah, it is incredibly moving. I cry almost every episode.
I love shows where I cry almost every episode, to be honest. I love it.
Because it does in weird ways, like you said, Karen, like bring up insecurities and also make you feel okay about having them, but also like make you feel like, look at how far you've grown in certain ways, which is really, it's just really nice. And this last season, it gets much deeper because it's like the final chapter. And like, they did have that episode, but they discuss, like they talk about death and religion and, you know, illness, even to a certain extent, like consent, and it's very good. And this final season, the reason I brought it up and I said, oh, it's transition, they have a whole episode that's from the point of view of one of the girls' mothers, and so she becomes the main character, and so you get to see like things from her point of view, and it's just this really beautiful like portrayal of like, again, like as you grow up. I think it's also really nice because, you know, Maya had just become a mother in real life. She had just given birth. And now, and her, her mother on the show is played by her actual mother in real life, who's Japanese and had never acted before.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so the show, the episode is like about her first marriage and her life in Japan. And it has like pictures of her as a young woman. And it's so much of the episode is about like, how as you grow up, you start to see the people who cared for you in a different way. Like you start to see them as real people. Who
yeah.
Are
yeah.
Maybe less perfect than you thought or flawed, but they have their reasons. You start to yeah. see them as whole people. And
yeah,
it's a really beautiful episode. I think the whole series is beautiful. Again, it's not for everyone. I know some people can't get over the initial shtick of it, but
it's really making me feel like, you know, just your description is just making me feel like certain ways about yeah, I guess that, yeah, like that transition of like, you know, parents becoming less remote in terms of like their humanized points of view and their, you know, messy inner feelings and stuff. And also the fact that like pretty much nearly everyone I know like still mentally thinks like, not that they're maybe 13, but like, and you hear this from like old people, like most people still mentally think that they're about 17. Like, do any of you get that? Like that you don't like you mentally still see yourself as like not an adult.
Oh yeah, like every day I'm astounded that I'm allowed to like go out in the world and make decisions for
like
myself.
Live by yourself, like that you're not still like living with your parents or like, you know, whatever it is. Like maybe some people don't feel like that, but like nearly everyone I know mentally still feels about 16 to 20, even though they're like 35 plus. And, you know, they still feel that inner sense of like, yeah, that they're not adults and that they are faking it. And basically, like, someone was like, I can't remember where I saw this, but was like, you know, someone was like, I'm not an adult. I'm just a tall child holding a beer. And I, you know, I feel like everyone thinks that they are a child. Everyone still, like, has, you know, not maybe not every single person, but so many people still inherently feel like tapped into how they felt about things as a child, you know, especially anyone that's had like any kind of hard time. So that's kind of fascinating. I definitely thought it was like more comedic than what you're saying, like more, you know, slapsticky. I didn't know that it had that level of depth. Obviously, never have I ever. We've talked about like Davies' horrible anger and how great that is, like her psychosis, but this one I didn't know was that deep.
Yeah, I encourage you to check it out. It is also does have its comedic episodes for sure. I believe yeah. The third episode of season one is entirely about masturbation, so yeah.
And I guess that's kind of like a story they can tell when the actor is 31 and not really a 14-year-old girl.
Yes.
Or whatever. Mm-hmm.
They also did a crossover episode with Big Mouth, which you guys know.
Really? How does that work?
They were just animated in Big Mouth and like their characters showed up in the cafeteria, basically.
Is it Big Mouth Netflix show?
Yeah, it is.
And this is Hulu.
Yes. Don't know any of the behind the scenes stuff, but I remember people like talking about that. And like, I knew who they were because, you know, their faces are kind of iconic. Like if you're around the internet, I think you've seen them at least once or twice, but yeah, it was pretty cool. Big Mouth, also not for everybody, but one of my all time favorite shows. And
do you ever cry in that one?
I think I have. Not every episode, but there have been a few emotional moments. But I think it's kind of the same idea, too, is like all of the voice actors, at least, are obviously adults. And so, you know, you're watching children talk about sex and masturbation and all that kind of stuff. And it could be weird, but it's a strangely relatable show, especially as people grow into like their sexuality and stuff and like late bloomers and everything, I think there's a lot to think about there. And yeah, it could be weird, but somehow it still works. Maybe not for everybody, but for me at least.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know if I can. It does look a bit cringe for me, the big mouth stuff. I'm not going to lie.
That's fair.
it looks a bit like, but I don't know. I'm always like, people can sell me on anything. Like if they write it well enough, people can sell me on pretty much anything. So
I don't think you'll like big mouth.
No?
No, I really don't think you'll like it.
Okay. That's okay. I don't have to like everything. Brittany, have you watched Pen 15 or not?
Yeah, I have. It's really good. I thought that it would turn me off. It actually is like really easy to watch once you see one episode.
Well, there's another show doing that at the moment, isn't there? With like an adult playing a teenager at school, like the Chad, like Nassim Pedrad, she's playing like a 14-year-old boy, like on. Which is kind of weird to me. I don't know if that's like going to have the same level of seriousness as Pen 15, but it's kind of the same shtick in terms of the acting, you know, the acting thing, which is a bit unusual. I don't know. I can't wait for Never Have I Ever season 3. Have they even renewed it for season 3?
Yeah, they're writing it.
Oh, good. Yeah, we obviously love that. And yeah, I've talked about that one quite extensively on an episode of this show called Poor Little Rich Boy. Yeah, it is a good one. I am going to check out Pen 15. I was really not into it based on the idea of that casting, but I believe in you, Arianna, so I'm going to try it. Now, Brittany, what was your biggest overarching 2021 hype?
It's really lame. But I, as Natalie said, all the way at the top of the episode, one of my like favorite things to do in life and in general is just go out and travel and go see things like shows, like Broadway shows, concerts, literally anything to get out of the house. And I'll do it by myself. I don't need company. I am just happy to, you know, enjoy things that I enjoy without the pressure of having someone else there needing to entertain them and make sure they're having a good time. And so one of the things that I really leaned into during the pandemic at the end of last year and into this year is, so The Killers released an album last summer, which was perfect timing. It was like June and things were getting bad again because like summer was iffy. Like, can we go outside? Can we not go outside? I was going on a lot of walks and there was a new album that came out and it was good. It wasn't like one of those things that you're listening to because you have to. That came out in 2021. Their new album is something, not bad, but also not great. But the 2020 album was so good. And then I really started really getting back into just listening to The Killers nonstop, all the old albums. Like I was looking up videos, deep cuts, watching concerts of theirs on TV. And one thing in 2021 that they did, which was really great, was they did a lot of Instagram lives, which normally I have a lot of secondhand embarrassment and can't watch anything like that, where people are like paying attention to comments coming in and like staring at phone screens and trying to do things. But Brandon Flowers just looks so miserable to be there every time he does it that I watched every single one of them.
That's not very nice.
He is just like trying so hard to give the people what they want. And I appreciated him so much for doing it because normally I would watch for like 2 seconds and like bounce on something like that. But anytime they were like Instagram live coming in 2 days, I was like, and we're setting a reminder because this is going to be a train wreck. And it was just so great. They like didn't know what they were doing anytime that they got on, and fantastic. Just a really bright spot during my days, especially because they would do them like in the middle of the day and they were writing the album at the time and like, you know, doing final mixes and stuff. So they'd play some like tracks from it. And it was just all very entertaining. And then as the summer was coming to an end, they announced, you know, all right, we're going to go back on tour starting at the end of 2021 and into like a full-blown tour in 2022. And that gave me like a lot of hope because over the summer, you know, things were looking okay. They were okay. People were vaccinated. For a bright,
shining moment.
Yeah. You know, people were vaccinated and whatnot. And then I had the opportunity to go see the Killers in September. And so I took it. I wasn't planning on going to see them. They were playing a couple of shows that were close to me, but one thing that the Killers do, which I really love, is they always play smaller venues before their big shows. Like if they're playing in Madison Square Garden, they'll announce a show like last minute at a venue like Terminal 5 or the Beacon Theater, just somewhere like a little smaller scale. And I was at the farmer's market with my Killers tote bag, and a girl who works at the stand where I get breakfast on Sunday mornings was like, oh, did you know that they're playing? She's a Killers fan. And we found this out because I always use the same tote bag for the farmer's market. And she's like, oh, did you hear that they're playing at this small venue in Philly, which is like really close to where I am? And I was like, no, I didn't hear that they, I didn't see that they announced
it. She comes from Philly to go to the, She comes to a New Jersey farmer's market.
No, she doesn't. She lives here. She said, did you hear they're playing a show in Philly, which is close to me?
But you're saying which is close to you.
It's only 25 minutes.
Oh, really?
Philly is really close to me.
Oh.
Yeah, it takes me 25 minutes to get to like the Ben Franklin Bridge, which goes right into Philly.
Oh.
It's really close.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So like it's the local area to you. Yeah. You're so always really, like, I'm in Philadelphia. I'm in Pennsylvania. And I'm like, why are you always in Pennsylvania?
I mean, so like the water that we look at the edge of my town, the other side of that is Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Cool. No problem. So what was the venue they were playing at in Philly?
So they were playing at, oh my God, why can't I remember the name of it? It was the first time I've ever been there. My brain shut off like 2 hours into the Ted Lasso conversation. Hold on.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I was listening to you guys, but then I stopped like having my own thoughts because I was paying attention to you guys. Franklin Music Hall.
I've been to one concert in Philly. It wasn't there, so I just was curious if it was where I went, but it's not. I mean, not of the Killers. Anyway, so you went to the Franklin Music Hall to see the Killers in September.
So in September, I went to Franklin
with your farmer's market friend.
I did not go with her, but I'm assuming she was there. But yeah, so I got the tickets. You had to be vaccinated and have a negative test, which I was like, okay, fantastic. I'll take those restrictions and wear a mask. And overall, I'd say very good mask compliance, but it was just 2 hours of feeling normal. And I was just so happy that they were able to give that to me this year.
Like the high end of normal.
Yeah.
Like what you do on a really good day when things are normal.
Exactly. And I'm a like stand in the crowd, head bop type of person. That was not this concert. I had a freaking blast. I loved every single second of it. They played my two favorite songs. I was a happy camper, and it really held me over for a long time.
Hang on to that one.
Yeah.
What are your two favorite songs?
Runaways is one of my all time favorite songs. And then most recently, I love the song Dying Breed off of their new album.
Mm-hmm.
So that was great. I had a really, really wonderful time. They didn't play a single song that I hated. Not that I actually don't hate any of their songs. But yeah, it was just fantastic. And at one point, Brandon Flowers like sat down on the speaker and he was just like, listen, this is the first time I've played 3 shows in a row. I might not make it to the end of the show. He's like, it's been a very long time since I've done this.
I mean, it's a fitness thing for a lot of men. Like, it's a real, like, they
and
have
he does
to have
not
like a lot of
stand
stamina.
Still. It's just like running back and forth on that stage the whole time. But it was good. The energy was great. The crowd was very good. You could tell people were just like really happy to be out and doing something. Yeah. And so I think that that energy is something that we've lost a lot of, like, in
but
terms
people
of like
are so nervous about it, you know, like,
yeah. Well, no, I meant like, I'm sorry. I meant like towards like, let's say pre-pandemic, like people were very just like, I deserve to like be here and my good time is better than your good time. And that was fair enough.
Like, people are jaded and like,
and that was just not there.
Everyone's really not taking it for granted anymore.
Exactly. Like, everyone was just there. And like, I've never seen more people be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Excuse me. Are you okay if I stand here? Like, is that like, that never happens. Granted, this is like a health cautious thing, but otherwise, it was just, it felt very like, it was a very different vibe and it was very cool and fun. And I'll probably never go into a room of people again. Granted, I really want to see Spider-Man, but I can't foresee myself willingly going to a movie theater anytime soon. So
yeah,
it was just, it was nice. It was a nice escape. And I am still listening to them. They're my number one go-to car music, but yeah, I'm just, that was my hype. They came back full force into my life this year, and little like touch points throughout the year, just like these Instagram things, like little doses of serotonin, but that one big boost of serotonin carried me through to like November. So that's good. I'm very happy.
You've seen one Broadway show. Is that it before it got bad again?
Yeah, I saw one Broadway show. My college has like a fund that is James Lapine went to my graduated from my college, and he has like a fund in place at the school to like sponsor trips to see shows. And he just opened a new show on Broadway called Flying Over Sunset. And the school, you know, my English department like reached out to alumni who were like local, and we were able to go and see the show and sit with James Lapine while he was like taking notes during previews to like give the actors. And then he came and talked with us afterwards, and Tom Kitt did the music of the show. And so he came out and
really
spoke with us as well.
Really interesting combination of writer and composer.
Yeah, it was. And it was really cool. He's a very, very nice person.
So is it like, it's not just like anyone can pick up a ticket from James Lapine. It's like, on this day, we are doing all of the James Lapine scholarship tickets and you can all come as a group.
Yeah. So like they try to like do it as a trip because the school, like the school's in Pennsylvania. So like they sponsor like the bus and everything. So they try to do it as a group thing. And then, you know, he was going to talk to us. So, you know, they wanted everyone to be there at one time. So that was like, it was really cool. And then I got to see like, you know, some old professors and people I, you know, worked with at this like program on campus. So it was a lot of fun and like interesting, and it was a very exciting time for him and right before the very sad time for him. So I'm glad
we
got to see him at that point.
He's definitely become like more in the public conversation very, very recently due to the death of Stephen Sondheim, because he's the book writer of one of the most famous of Sondheim's shows, Sunday in the Park with George, which I gave Karen a full rundown about recently. I was like, you have to understand this musical, because apparently she has a picture of the print in her house and
you should probably know about the musical.
And like, that's the show that they won the Pulitzer for. And so yeah, that's really interesting. Have you guys, Ariana and Karen, have you seen any live events this year, or are you like still staying away?
I don't think I have. I've gone to the movies a couple of times. That's not really a live event, but I'm still very much like staying inside. I go to a few places and like I go to trivia every week, and that has really helped me feel like things were kind of normal. But anytime I'm like in a new place where I'm not sure if they're keeping up with protocols and stuff like that, I still get very nervous and anxious. And my anxiety is so much worse than it was pre-pandemic. I'm really out of practice for social interaction, and it's been very stressful.
Yeah. Arianna, what about you? Have you been out to any kind of live entertainment in California?
Lol, no.
No.
No. I work every weekend, and I mean, mostly it's because I'm a loser and work every weekend. I've done nothing, truly. I went to lunch this weekend and got COVID exposed. So, I mean, it's not in the cards for me.
No. I also, unfortunately, have not been able to have very many good experiences. At the very beginning of the year, I went to a couple of comedy shows, like live shows, which were great. I actually, right in January, Karen, you asked me about Daniel Sloss. I went to a Daniel.
So jealous.
Yeah. So I saw a live stand-up show of Daniel Sloss in January. And then I saw a stand-up show of one of my favorite Australian comedians earlier in the year. And then we shut down again in the middle of the year for no venues were operating. Like I think I saw, I went to the cinema maybe once in June, and then they shut down again until about October, due to a rise of cases here. Again, it's not high compared to the States, but we shut down pretty fast. Right now we should be shutting down again because it's gotten much worse. And it's all because we haven't, our COVID stuff's managed, state by state. And the head of state, is called the premier. I guess it's, a governor. I don't know. The point is, our old premier, who was quite shit, got ousted because of some sort of, personal scandal. And the replacement is also bad. And he's really anti-shutdown. He's really right-wing and kind of pandering to, the people who are, let us get back to normal despite everything. And we were pretty close. We had 95% double vax rate in the state. 95% of the population had got their double vax. But it's gone back up again, I assume, due to either Omicron or whatever it's called, or the fact that basically for the first the soft opening of lockdown, it was you had to be vaxxed and show a vax certificate to go to places like the cinema and stuff like that, or anywhere non-essential. And then in very early December, they were okay, now everyone can go whether you're vaxxed or not. And I don't know if it's that 5% of people that's brought the numbers up or if it's the new variant, but either way, we should be shutting down again and they're just not doing it. So yeah, I don't think that we'll have a good time anytime soon. I'm not worried about the cinema. Our levels are not as bad to be worried about that. I'm just picking really empty sessions. So I did see Spider-Man at the cinema, and I saw Black Widow and Shang-Chi at the cinema. Once our cinemas reopened, they kind of re-showed the stuff that had come out while we were closed. But I'm only going for really big things that I really want to see on a big screen, as opposed to something I would feel good watching at home. No live events since very early in the year. No travel. Nothing. No, sucks. If you guys could do one thing in 2022 that you haven't been able to do since COVID has started, what would it be?
You'd think I'd miss more things, but
yeah, everything just makes me anxious now. I'm like, do I really want to go places and see people?
I don't know. Do you? You went to New York. Oh, sorry. You went to Rhode Island.
Yeah.
You got on a plane. I haven't been on a, how many have you been on a plane since it started?
Well, technically, I had to get on a plane to come home the week it started.
That's but true.
Otherwise, no, I haven't been on a
plane. Is that when you were in Geneva?
No, I was in Miami Beach.
Yeah, Florida. Yeah. Arianna, did you get on a plane to New Mexico or did you drive?
Yeah, no, I had to get on a plane to New Mexico. That was probably, I feel like, the best time to go because that was
wintery?
That was like after Delta and before Omicron. So everyone was like, oh, like everything is fine now. You're double vaxxed. Yeah. Everything's cool. So that was the best time to go.
Was that good to travel?
I mean, I hate planes.
Well, I mean, after the plane, the leaving California, was that good or?
It was nice to do something, I guess. Yeah. I also worked that entire time, including weekends. So, but it was a change of scenery.
I guess so. Karen, you've gotten on a plane.
Twice, actually.
How was that?
I don't mind flying. The people make me more anxious than the plane does. I actually felt okay because you're required to wear a mask both in the airport and on the plane at all times. And I felt much safer that way. I'm vaccinated and everything. And I did wait to go to Rhode Island until after I had all of that. And now I have my booster and I am planning to go home to New York for post-Christmas celebrations. But it still makes me anxious. I don't really like doing it, but I haven't seen my dad in 2 years and it sucks. My mom drove out here to come visit me over the summer and that was nice, but it's weird. And I want to get back to normal, but at the same time, I don't want to do that before everything is okay again. And that's still going to be a long, long time from now.
I have not gotten on a plane. And I have nowhere to go. Obviously, I'm not going to travel internationally. And so that's kind of really boring and isolating.
I kept getting emails telling me I should go to Australia.
I mean, you can come to Australia. That would be good. We have less COVID here. But, yeah, what Brittany said about, kind of the Killers concert sustaining her for kind of several months. You know, when I travel to the States, if I go to LA or Comic-Con or New York, or if I travel to London to see my friends there, those social events and, the cool things that we do when we're there, kind of seeing big productions or kind of things that don't come to Australia, those kind of social events and also the theatre events or whatever, either conventions or gigs or shows, they sustain me usually for my year of not doing anything in Australia. So I haven't done any of that. Since November 2019. So yeah, pretty bored of that. So yeah, pretty bored of not doing anything particularly fulfilling, like not creating any good memories to sustain. Yeah. Fun. Let's move on. So we've got a really good question of the day this time, which is from someone on Twitter who is a person that I know in fandom, who I've known her in fandom for a pretty long time. She's like a pretty prolific fan fiction writer who's written for a few fandoms that I have followed over the years. And her question is, her handle is Lupagus or Lupagus. I don't know how she pronounces it, but I've always said Lupagus, but we call her Gus, like when I'm actually speaking to her as a friend. She said her hype of the year is also Ted Lasso. Got me through this hellish year, got me chatting with a bunch of old friends and introduced me to a bunch of fantastic new people. So, yeah, that's been a really big thing for her. She's one of the people that's basically started one of the most popular fandom pairings in Ted Lasso. Like she wrote a weird pairing that people really love, which is one of the most popular pairings in the fandom, way more popular than the stuff that I read. Like the amount of fan fiction created for her pairing is like three or four times as much as what I get. So I'm jealous of that. But her question is, what established actor, writer, or creator most surprised you this year with their new work? Which I thought this was such a good question. I don't know, you know, what her answer was. Like, it might have been Jason Sudeikis or it might have been someone else in mind, but I have a few people in mind. But does everyone have an answer for this?
Yes.
Yes.
Cool. Karen, do you want to go first?
Yeah, that's probably for the best, because I feel like this is such a good question that I don't have as profound of an answer as I wanted to have. But because I am a little biased, I'm actually going to say Dylan O'Brien. Dylan did Infinite with Mark Wahlberg. It was basically about, you know, these characters who have past lives. Dylan plays one of Mark Wahlberg's past lives, and he's always been fantastic. And I think that he's doing more adult roles recently. He did American Assassin and was very good in that. But this is the first time that I saw him as like a grown man doing a very like grown man kind of role. And and I, like, that sounds mean almost, but I think he still is able to play like young 20s or like quirky teenager kind of roles. Like, he's still kind of Style Stilinski in my head. And whenever he kind of branches out of that, I'm always very impressed with what he does. And like I said, I enjoyed American Assassin, and I think he was very good in it. For me, Infinite was so interesting because even though Mark Wahlberg leads the movie and is obviously a big name in and of itself, I think that they should have switched roles. Mark Wahlberg played like the current day version of the character who's rediscovering that he has these past lives, and Dylan plays him in the past during previous life. I think that it would have been a better movie if they switched, because Dylan's performance was so powerful and he wasn't even in it that much. It was just like some flashback scenes, but he gave it his all. And there was such like a maturity to that role that I was really, really impressed by it, even though I've enjoyed literally everything else he's done. So that was about that the
pretty biased.
Yeah, it is. I know.
You don't have anyone that you like didn't rate before, or like you had a totally different idea of them before, and now you have like a new idea of them. I mean, it's fine. I accept the answer. But it's really biased.
The only other person that I could really think of was Awkwafina in Shang-Chi, because some people have some gripes against her for very, very valid reasons. And her brand of outlandish comedy has never really landed that well with me. She's done other things, and I've heard great things about some of her other roles. But she really impressed me in Shang-Chi, because I felt like we still got a bit of her comedy, a bit of her usual style, but it was a little more mature. And the way that they kind of set her up in that movie to continue on is really interesting to me. And I'm really curious to see her and Sean, like what they're going to be like down the line. So
yeah,
that was my backup one.
That's cool.
Was that better?
Karen, did you see Dylan O'Brien in the Taylor Swift music video? Because I thought that's what you were going to bring up.
Yes, I did. Oh my God. Maybe I should have talked about that. He was. Yes.
And I really liked that. I actually really liked that in terms of, yeah, playing an adult, playing a 30-year-old man and playing, you know, 29-year-old man, and actually, you know, forcing people to perceive him not as the teenage character, as the kind of manipulative older man. And I really like the press that he did about it, being like, yeah, I understand the assignment. He literally was like, yeah, I understood the assignment, gaslight the fuck out of her. Like he said that. And I'm like, okay. Even though I love Jake Gyllenhaal and I don't wish to perceive him in that, you know, the whole Taylor Swift situation, I like to kind of keep that separate in my head from the fact that I really, really do like Jake Gyllenhaal. But it was a great video. Ariana, do you have an answer for this one in terms of what established creator or artist really surprised you with their new work, or like a new spin on them in 2021?
Yes. And my answer is the one that we did an entire podcast about, Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah.
Rom-com king of our generation. He's obviously been churning out this work for years, but as I only discovered Miracle Workers this year, getting to see him do comedy and especially like play, like, I guess you could say like the romantic hero, has been really delightful. He's so talented, so multifaceted. Give him all the flowers.
I love that. Yeah, I had a feeling that you might pick him after our last podcast, but yeah. Do you know what if he's got anything coming up for 2022?
I know he went to a bachelor party recently. Bachelor as in The Bachelor on ABC.
Oh.
he's a Bachelor fan.
He went to appear on a what, like a podcast about it, or just like a with the people in The Bachelor? Like you just went to hang out with them?
He was on a Bachelor podcast and then they had like a party. That's really likes The Bachelor, I guess. I really like funny. The Bachelor. If anybody watched last night, Michelle found her true love. I'm very excited about it. But
he's going to be in The Lost City too. I'm very excited about that.
That movie looks fucking amazing.
So excited.
I remember seeing the concept of that with our friend Sandra Bullock, who we've talked about so much recently, and my best friend in the world, Channing Tatum, and this whole idea of her being, you know, she's the romance writer stranded with her cover model. And I'm just like, this, I need this.
I mean, I'm barely hearing about this right now. Thank you, Karen. But this is the best idea I've ever heard of.
And I only recently saw that Dan Rad was in it. Like there was that, they kind of did a clip announcing it with the three of them. I don't understand what role he has, if he's her publisher or her assistant or what.
Do you want to know what role he has?
Yes.
He's basically the megalomaniac billionaire who kind of like, I don't know if he kidnaps them, but he gets like wrapped up in, he basically wants her to help him find the lost city that she writes about. And he's like an insane millionaire, crazy person.
I am obsessed with this.
It's incredible.
I didn't even get to watch the trailer yet. I just saw a video that they did like announcing it. Like I just saw like them as doing like a piece of press.
Oh, I didn't even see that. I just saw a poster.
Oh my God. Watch the trailer. It's so good.
I definitely am keen on this because I mean I love Channing, like I love Channing Tatum like so much, and you know we've had so much discussion of Sandra Bullock lately, and we really I remember ages ago hearing about this premise and then like forgetting about it, and then the trailer, like the news came out and I was like, oh my God, like this is gonna be so fun and so funny and yeah, so good. And I'm very excited to see that and him. I just think this is going to be a really fun time. When does that come out exactly? Does anyone know? March. So soon. So exciting. I think what they did was like a presentation of like, it was like, it's like, we're all on a stage presenting the trailer, I think was basically what it was that I saw. But then I don't know what happened. Maybe it was in the middle of the night or something. And I didn't get to keep watching it, but I'm going to go and watch it directly after this. Very exciting. Brittany, do you have an answer for this question?
I do. And my answer is Selena Gomez in Only Murders in the Building.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, she was the only holdout for me, like accepting this show at face value. And I was so pleasantly surprised by her from the second she was on screen and just loved her more and more and more as the show went on, and just her ability to just go toe for toe with the giants of Steve Martin and Martin Short were just, it was unbelievable. And I loved
their dynamic so much. And she was just so good. And I didn't have any like bad expectations. I just was unsure of what she would do. Yeah. And it's so pleasantly surprised and really, really loved her in this and want her to do so much more.
I agree with every single thing you've said. I really found her so good in this. So yeah, it's you know, and I knew that she had acted. I didn't really think about like, and I think it's like really impressive. I don't know how she got the role, but I think that it's like really impressive that, you know, if she has had any issues with like Disney Channel kind of typecasting or anything like that, like I find it really impressive that she's got such a, like, you know, transcended that, like made people pay attention to her as a serious actor and all of that, because she's so good. She's so good in it. I kind of wished that I could have done a writer for this one, like that I oh, you did this, but like, you know, I'm really impressed with that. But generally, if I like a writer, I like I'm not necessarily like surprised by them. Like, you know, I could be pleasantly surprised, but I'm not going to be like, oh, I didn't see you that way. Like, I tend to like writers for what they write. I've definitely discovered a lot of like new writers, especially like television writers this year that I've really love, you know, but they're not like a transformation of the idea. So I do have an actor one as well. I've actually got, and one of them is someone that I hated before and now love, and one of them is someone who I've always loved but just took me to the next level. The person that I did not like that I now am really into is Hailee Steinfeld. I haven't seen that much of what she did before, but I have seen Pitch Perfect, and I could not fucking stand her in these movies. I think it's the character, not her. Like, I don't have like a problem with her face or anything, but I hated her so much in the Pitch Perfect sequel that I just found her so cringe. Again, it's the character, not, I don't know. And I don't know. I don't think she was meant to be cringe. I just couldn't stand her. I never saw Edge of 17 or True Grit. Like, I don't know, like that she, you know, I don't know if she's actually good, like known as being good or not. But my main experience with her was very negative association. And this year she's, you know, right now, like she had two shows airing. Again, another Apple TV show, Dickinson, which is kind of this anachronistic Emily Dickinson biopic. And that's been going for a few seasons, but I only got Apple this year. And the third season, you know, is when it starts getting really gay, and that it just got really, really gay. And she is so cute and good. I find this show really interesting. And then in conjunction with that airing, she's also playing Kate Bishop in the Hawkeye series on Disney Plus. And I am really attached to that character from the comics. Like the Hawkeye series on Disney Plus is based really closely on a particular iteration of Hawkeye comics, which was written by a guy called Matt Fraction, drawn by a guy called David Aja. There's a really iconic look to them, really iconic story about that version of Clint Barton and his partnership with Kate Bishop, who is the next Hawkeye, like the next person to take the mantle of Hawkeye, this young in the Young Avengers. And the MCU version isn't quite the same in terms of like Clint's role in the world, but it really captures a lot of the same points. Like, it captures a lot of the same essence of the comic, a lot of the, you know, the things that made it funny and made it good. When I saw that they were actually doing the Matt Fraction Hawkeye, just from stills and stuff, I was like, okay, this is everything I've wanted. But, you know, I still, you know, Jeremy Renner, he never really felt like the right Clint from the comics for me. And I had such this negative idea of Hailee Steinfeld as an actress. Honestly, they're both really good in the Hawkeye series. Like, he's fine. Like, he's, I'm accepting how they have tried to mash comics Clint with the weird way that Joss Whedon kind of twisted the MCU Clint in the Avengers. That meant they had to make this track that just doesn't actually make sense for Clint's comic stories. But leaving that aside, Hayley Steinfeld as Kate Bishop is so funny. It's so, she's so good. I am so happy that she's really capturing everything I loved about the character. In the most recent episodes, they've got her going toe-to-toe with Florence Pugh as Yelena from Black Widow. Oh, my God. It's so good. I loved it so much. And she is just, I'm just really thrilled that she is great in the way that I, like, because Kate is a really comedic character with a really funny, you know, even her facial expressions, the way it's drawn. And Hayley, yeah, I did not have faith that this was my Kate Bishop, but she is really great. And I'm really, really happy about that. And the other person is one of my favorite people in the whole world who this year has just done things that I didn't think was possible, which is Andrew Garfield. I love him. Like, I always loved him. I adore him. He is never on social media. So it's not like he isn't like a constant presence in the world. He's kind of like, he comes, he does a film, there's a press tour about it. Everyone talks about him for a while and then he goes away again, which, like, good for him, to be honest. I have loved him for a very, very long time. I was in the room at Hall H at Comic Con when he did, when he first appeared as Spider-Man, when he crashed the panel in his Spider-Man onesie and did this really emotional speech at the microphone about what it meant for him to be playing Peter Parker. But I love him in all the roles he's done. I went to New York to see him in Angels in America and he was so good. I had the most strange experience with him, or witnessed the most strange experience with him after the stage door, which made me like want to take a bullet for him. And this year he is really on everyone's lips for a variety of reasons. He's really like, I think like finally the kids now know about Andrew Garfield in a way that they kind of wrote him off before, because not that many people liked his Spider-Man. But it's really Tick, Tick, Boom, the biopic of Jonathan Larson that he starred in, directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, that really stunned me. Like, I love this actor and I did not know that he was capable of what he did in that movie. It is unbelievable. And it's, you know, he didn't even sing before that movie aired. He'd never sung, you know, he'd never done musical theater. He'd never had singing training. You know, apparently how it goes is that Lin saw him in Angels in America and was like, I think that you've got like the energy that I could use for this movie to play John Larson. He's like, can you sing? And Andrew apparently was like, well, when are you making the movie? And Lin was like, probably in about a year from now. And Andrew was like, then yes, I can sing. Because he then went and got voice and piano training to basically open up his voice and be able to kind of sing in the way that he needed to. And I mean, John Larson wasn't a great singer. Like, he was, I think Andrew's tone in the songs that he performs is actually better than just better quality than the original, because John was like a composer. He was presenting his songs that were going to be sung by other professional singers. But what he does in that movie and what it, the different, like the multitude of different ways that it was representing really meaningful things, both in my life, my history with musical theatre, my interest, you know, and also just the world's history with musical theatre, you know, the legacy of Stephen Sondheim to Jonathan Larson to Lin-Manuel Miranda, which is like a pretty tightly linked chain. Like, no one could have made that movie aside from Lin. And I'm so amazed that he was like, that's the guy to play. I never would have called it. Like, for the first things, I would have picked an American, like, but I never would have called it for him to get Andrew to play Jonathan Larson. It's so good. He will, I think he will win the Oscar for it. He will definitely be nominated and I think he will win. And I just found, like, this is kind of like Dylan in that this is someone I loved like so much, but this performance is like mind-blowing, especially the singing, but just the energy of it and what he put into it is incredible. So yeah, I'm really, really happy with the amount of attention on him at the moment, because lots of cool interviews after Tick, Tick, Boom, and, you know, hopefully more in the For Your Consideration cycle. And yeah, he was just great. Brittany, did you end up watching it?
Yeah, I've watched it three times.
Three times, yeah. Karen?
Yeah, I watched it, and yeah. I, you know, don't really know much about a lot of that, and I was floored. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I was like, I need to go and see it at the cinema. Like, it aired for basically like 5 days in cinema screenings here, and before I watched it on Netflix, I was like, I want to go see it at the cinema. Like, I feel I'm going to go by myself in the middle of the day and I'm going to see it at the cinema. And I'm really glad that I did, because it was a very emotional experience for me. And yeah, so that was a big deal. Anyway, I think that is everything, unless anyone else has any other examples that they wanted to give.
No, I think that's it.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll finish up and we will, I guess, you know, you'll hopefully be hearing this on New Year's Eve, and then we'll hear from you again in 2022. So, yeah, in the meantime, if you would like to follow us on NATW Podcast and on Subjectify Media, we would really love that if you would follow us and talk to us and send us a question of the day, or just, you know, anything that you want to engage with us about. Yeah, that would be cool. Brittany.
Yes.
You have.
I thought you were going to ask. Finish your question.
Just doing some dramatic effect.
It was Brittany. Very dramatic.
Yeah. Brittany.
Yeah.
Do you have what I'm looking for?
I do.
Okay.
All right. So as we close out every Not About the Weather, here is our, I don't even know how we say this, what, haiku conclusion?
High conclusion.
You'd think I'd know by now.
It's so stupid, but yeah.
So here we go. Farewell, 2021. This show is not sponsored by Apple TV Plus.
But we're open to it.
Yeah. You don't know how many times I was counting syllables to get that to work.
We've really gone we've got Ted Lasso, Mythic Quest, Dickinson. I'll throw in another awesome Apple Plus TV Plus show that I wanted to talk about this year but didn't, which is the Ewan McGregor documentary series Long Way Up, which is the third part of his Motorbike Around the World series that he made like 15 years after the first one. That was something Apple TV Plus also produced and aired, and that was an awesome experience for me this year too. So, yeah, okay, Apple TV Plus, we're here for you. Come on. Thank you guys for joining me and speaking to me and keeping me company.
Thanks for a great year.
Yay! Yeah. Okay, bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
As soon as you asked if we had any more examples, and I said no,
what's the example?
I really loved Owen Wilson in Loki. I thought he did a great job.
That's a great call. Yeah, I'll put that in as a blooper. That's a great call.
I was like, no, Owen Wilson. But we moved on too quickly.
That's a great call, actually. I love that. I'll leave that in. Cool.
I'm also shocked by how many people have told me this week that they hate Hailee Steinfeld.
Really? Who else has told you? Just other people?
Just other people. But you guys should really see True Grit. She's fabulous in it. She's 14.
Yeah. Kristen's actually a huge fan of hers, and she had me watch Edge of 17, and I really didn't know what I was getting into, but she is fantastic in that movie.
I really like her.
She's a great actress.
I don't like Pitch Perfect, so I never watched beyond the first one. Like, I hated the first one, so I don't have any opinion of her.
I watched the second one, and oh my god, I wanted to stab a character with a pencil.
I've never seen her in that, which is good, but I've loved everything else that, you know, I've seen.
I feel bad now, but
True Grit is in my top five favorite movies of all time, and really? A lot of it is because of her. It's Oscar nominated, and she's the best part of it.
Wow.
I've seen that movie and I remember liking it, but I don't really remember anything about it.
I don't. I definitely have no idea what it's about.
She was in Bumblebee, which Dylan's voice was in.
I didn't see that. I've never seen a Transformer, Karen. You know.
It's rude.
That was like such a reaction.
I'm sorry. I was taken aback.
I haven't seen True Grit. When did it come out? 2014? No.
No, earlier. Like 2010. Yeah.
Oh, it's a Coen Brothers movie.
It has Matt Damon. It has, oh God, who plays Mr. Cogburn?
Jeff Bridges, according to Wikipedia.
Yes, that makes sense.
It's really good.
Well, I don't hate her anymore.
She also voices Spider-Gwen.
Yeah, so. I know. But
that's not really like liking her. She's just
she's no Florence Pugh, but
did you watch the finale yet?
No, I'm about to. Okay. Why?
It's very
good. I'm so behind.
Oh my God. Karen, get it together. Yeah.
That reminds me though, that Little Women is also a Christmas movie, so we should add that to our list.
Oh yeah.
Florence is amazing in that. So funny. Yeah, okay. We can be done now. But thank you for your Owen Wilson. No, Owen Wilson.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I was literally, as I was saying the word no, I was like, oh, wait, I thought of one.